time is now. Don't think I've forgotten what you've done to me. Bombing, castration, lynchings, and killings are part of my reality. This just can't go on. I won't be your slave. Burn the nanny, Negro, quick chain driver, or your maid. I want my land without your earth.
212-209-2950. That's the number to call. 212-209-2950. This is WBAI New York. It is the, what day is it today? Wednesday edition of the program. And, we are offering this afternoon as a thank you gift with your pleasure, the $100 level, your very own copy of this documentary, this powerful documentary, this living history, to which we're sharing with you this afternoon. It is Before They Die. It is the quest for justice for the survivors of the Tulsa race riots of 1921. Today, this month, this May, marks the 90th anniversary of the Tulsa race riot. The 90th anniversary. And we ask you to help us to make sure that this history remains a very powerful and remains in the forefront of the public consciousness, that this history will never again be either excised or forgotten. 212-209-2950 is our telephone number. We'd like you now to join Janet McPherson, who is in Far Rockaway. Thank you very much, Janet McPherson, for your support. We'd like you to join Franklin Jagru, who called us also from Far Rockaway with a pledge of support, with his pledge of support at the $100 level, 212-209-2950. Remember that you can make a pledge at any level that is comfortable and convenient for you. 212-209-2950 is the telephone number. Rebecca Collier, in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you so much for your support. Rita Roth, in Princeton, New Jersey. Thank you so much for your support. We also have many of you who have called who are modest and, well, perhaps who just choose to remain anonymous, one of whom has the name of a former Minister of Information for whom I once worked in a rather long time ago. I wonder if it is the same person. And another of our anonymous callers here in New York. This is a very distinguished gentleman with whom I had the opportunity a couple of weekends ago of sharing some time at a charitable event, for the Kiwanis, for the LaGuardia Kiwanis. So, look, thank you so much for all of your support, Michael G. Haskins.
Oh, that's great.
That's right.
That's wonderful.
Isn't it?
I wouldn't be
a small world.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. But thank you so much for those calls that have just come in for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. We're offering this afternoon Before They Die, the true story of the survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race riot and their quest for justice. It's a DVD. We'll send that to you as a thank you gift for supporting Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton, the program Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton, and the entire the access to information that you have every day, Monday through Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m. 212-209-2950. I'd like to thank Washington Robinson from Newark, New Jersey, called in with a pledge of support. Winston Bent from Brooklyn, New York. That's right. Barry Alexander from Rosedale, New York. Thank you so much, Barry. Horace Booker from Jamaica, New York. And Ms. Mayoshi Lusson from Spring Valley, New York, calling in with a pledge of support for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Please join those people that are calling in right now. We can accommodate 15 of you at any one time. 15 calls right now to 212-209-2950. You are supporting this radio station. You're supporting the program Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. This is not this program that Hugh has presented this afternoon. It's not just for the black members of the audience. By no means is it that. Mm. It's for all of us because this is American history. This was almost excised from history, but some people, some committed folks got together and brought this forward. They said, no, we are not going to allow this to go forward. And there's a lot of that going around in mm-hmm. terms of American history, but that's another story. But we're talking about right now before they die. Make your calls right now to 212-209-2950. It's a sore on America. We're trying to excise that. We're giving you information. We're presenting this, and we hope that you will support the program.
Indeed, 212-209-2950. We're now in the final hour of the program. We've been given the opportunity of this extended edition of the program today. I was not here live yesterday, as you know, and, I was here on Monday. Here I am again today, and we're asking you to support TalkBack, to support this program that is dedicated to the advancement of the public understanding. And now here's the other thing. I just got off the phone with Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Many of you remember her. Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall is Associate Professor of Constitutional Law at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, and a former civil rights litigator. She is also the founder and executive director of the Law and Policy Group. And I just got off the phone with her because I was just given during this last within this past hour, I was just given a package, and I opened the package, and there it was. Professor Brown Marshall made good. She sent us 10 copies of her U.S. Constitution and African American Context. Now this is a pocket-sized edition of the United States Constitution and African American Context. And as Professor Brown Marshall has explained to us before on this program, she constructed this unique pocket-sized U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Constitution and African American Context, because few people know about the Constitution, and even fewer know that the U.S. Constitution contains references directly and indirectly to people of African descent. And so she sent us these 10 copies, and she said to me, listen, if you would like to, you can give these 10 copies away to the next 10 of your callers who get this documentary before they die. Because at issue here, remember, is the 14th Amendment, the equal protection of the law, is what is at issue here. What the Tulsa race riot represented was a direct violation of the protection of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. So we now have 10 copies of Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall's African American Constitution, the U.S. Constitution and African American Context. It is the complete U.S. Constitution, which also contains the Declaration of Independence, as well as comments, cases, and facts about black people and the law. So the next 10 of you who call us at 212-209-2950 and who make a tax-deductible contribution to WBAI at the $100 level, you will get, in addition to the documentary Before They Die, you will also get a complimentary copy of Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall's U.S. Constitution and African American Context. So the number to call is 212-209-2950. I have 10 copies, we're only going to offer 10 copies because we have them in house. I have them in my hand. In fact, I have them right here. Let me hold up one of the copies to the microphone for you. Here it is right here. You listen to that? Right, that's me waving it about. It's the pocket-sized U.S. Constitution and African-American Context. This is the second edition with editorial comments by Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall, Professor of Constitutional Law at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, CUNY, and also she is the founder and executive director of the Law and Policy Group. You can find out more about their work over at lawandpolicygroup.org. Professor Brown Marshall's earlier book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to the Present, received the Ida B. Wells Barnett Justice Award. She's been doing this for a while. So 212-209 2950 is the number to call, and the next 10 of you will get a complimentary copy of Professor Brown Marshall's U.S. Constitution, An African American Context, together with your documentary Before They Die. Before They Die is a documentary 1.5 hours long. It's available on DVD, and it tells the story of the Tulsa Race Riot or pogrom of 1921. This is the worst race riot ever to have occurred in American history, and the story is told through the voices and the perspectives of the survivors. You also hear from the historians and researchers and the legal experts who have come together to try to obtain some form of justice for these survivors before they die. Among those experts, Professor Michael Hausfeld, who is internationally renowned for his work on behalf of Holocaust survivors. Professor Michael Hausfeld is a part of that dream team. We also heard so far in this documentary from such other luminaries as Professor John Hope Franklin, the late Professor John Hope Franklin, a native of Oklahoma, and himself and family survivor of of the Tulsa of the events in Tulsa, Scott Ellsworth, Scott Ellsworth, Professor Charles Ogletree, who is the leader of that legal dream team, Law Professor Leslie Mansfield, Law Professor Ajoa Ayatoro, the historian Robert Littlejohn, Professor Denario Solomon Simmons. These are among the voices, among the experts from whom you heard. You also heard from several of the survivors, including Dr. Olivia Hooker, Eldoris Macondici, Bishop Otis Granville Clark, Eunice Cloman Jackson, Wes Young, and many others. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. There's still more to come in this documentary, so we are going to return to the documentary in a moment, but it is now about 9 minutes, approaching 10 minutes after the hour. We're in the final hour of the program. In this hour of the program, in this final hour of the program, we need 60 calls, 60 calls in this final hour of the program. That's one call, a minimum of one call a minute, a minimum of 60 calls. We have 2, 4, 6 of those calls on the line at the moment, so we now need 54 additional calls. We would like you to be the first of those 54 remaining or additional calls. 212-209-2950. Remember, the U.S. Constitution, Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall's pocket-sized U.S. Constitution, An African-American Context, which also, in addition to the full U.S. Constitution, also included is the Declaration of Independence, together with comments, cases, and facts about black people and the law. We have 10 copies of that gift from Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall that we're using as an add-on this afternoon. So the first 10 of you who call and request this, when you make a pledge of support to WBAI this afternoon at the $100 level to get Before We Die, the documentary, we will also send you Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall's U.S. Constitution in African American Context. And you can find out more about that in the meantime while you await the arrival of the document itself by checking out the Law and Policy Group, of which Professor Brown Marshall is the founder and executive director. And I usually have her on several times a year and to discuss the U.S. Constitution. And in fact, she is... she also has been a substitute host on the program, an activity that she enjoys, and I know that you do as well, because you have pointed this out to me. 212-209-2950. Michael G. Hoskins, our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music, is here with me in studio. Let's bring you some dialing music. We're going to return to more of the documentary. Michael G. Hoskins is our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music. We're going to bring you some dialing music for a couple of minutes while you continue to get to the telephone, while you continue to call 212-209-2950 with your pledge of support at a level that is comfortable and convenient for you to this listener-sponsored commercial-free radio station. We do not accept corporate or commercial underwriting. We rely on you in order to keep the lights on and the microphones live. Your support is what keeps us going. Your support is what keeps this radio station on the air, this diadem in the middle of the FM dial. So here's a bit of dialing music while you get to the telephones. We'll be right back with more. Just enjoy. 212-209-2950. Please continue to call. Who is this, Michael G. Hoskins? This is
This is some music from South Africa, Afrique du Sud.
Ah, okay, Afrique du Sud, the music from South Africa here on WBA. And this is the other beautiful thing. There is no other radio station that will bring you as wide, as diverse, and as eclectic a range of incidental and other music as you will hear on this radio station. Just another compelling reason to call WBAI this afternoon with a pledge of support. And while you're calling, we're going to return to the documentary Before They Die in a moment. But I did promise that I wanted to get into some of what was reported by Walter White, who covered this event. He went down there to Tulsa and was able to file an extensive report for The Nation that was published on June 29th of 1921. And in that report, among the questions that he addressed, was what were the causes of the race riot that occurred in Tulsa, Oklahoma, this attack on the Black Wall Street? What were the causes of this event? Well, let me share some of what Walter White reported on this issue. And please, there's been a lull. We're now down to two callers on the line. Share this information with you, I'd like you to continue to call while I'm doing this. Otherwise, it is very distracting to me to have to. I keep looking. We have a light here that comes on every time someone is on the telephone. And I can see two of those right now, which means we have 13 lines available. This would be a great time for you to call. We have 13 lines available, and we have at least as many volunteers right now who are standing by to take those calls. So while I'm providing this background and contextual information, it would be wonderful if you could give us a call at 212-209-2950, make a pledge of support to WBAI at a level that is comfortable and convenient for you, so that we would know, so that we can continue to bring you this kind of information. So, getting now to Walter White's report on the causes for the race riot, he identifies a number of such causes. First, he writes, the Negro in Oklahoma has shared in the sudden prosperity that has come to many of his white brothers. And there are some colored men there who are wealthy. Remember, he's talking here about 1921. He writes, this fact has caused a bitter resentment on the part of the lower order of whites who feel that these colored men, members of an inferior race, in quotes, are exceedingly presumptuous in achieving greater economic prosperity than they who are members of a divinely ordered superior race. There are at least three colored persons in Oklahoma who are worth $1 million each. J.W. Thompson of Clairview is worth at least $500,000. There are a number of men and women worth $100,000 each, and many whose possessions are valued at $25,000 to $50,000 each. And this is particularly true of Tulsa. In one case where a colored man owned and operated a printing plant with $25,000 worth of printing machinery in it, the leader of the mob that set fire to and destroyed the plant was a linotype operator employed for years by the colored owner at $48 per week. Now, remember, we're talking here about 1921. So these are 1921 dollars. We're talking here about 1921 dollars. So you're talking about people here who are who are very wealthy by any American standard. Another reason he identifies here, quote, one of the charges made against the colored men in Tulsa is that they are radical. Questioning the whites more closely regarding the nature of this radicalism, I found it means that Negroes were uncompromisingly denouncing Jim Crow railroad cars, lynching, peonage, in short, were asking that the federal constitutional guarantees of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness be given regardless of color. And then he identifies a third factor, namely a large criminal element. He says, he writes, quote, a third cause was the rotten political conditions in Tulsa. A vice ring was in control of the city, allowing open operation of houses of ill fame, of gambling joints, the illegal sale of whiskey, the robbing of banks and stores with hardly a slight possibility of the arrest of the criminals and even less of their conviction. About 2 months ago, he writes, the state legislature assigned two additional judges to Tulsa County to aid the present two in clearing the badly clogged dockets. These judges found more than 6,000 cases awaiting trial. Thus, in a county of approximately 100,000 population, 6 out of every 100 citizens were under indictment for some sort of crime with little likelihood of trial in any of them. To illustrate the extent of the lawlessness that was taking that was common in Tulsa at the time, he tells the story of a white man by the name of Roy Belton, who had been accused of murdering a taxi cab driver. He was taken from the county jail and lynched. And according to the statements of many prominent Tulsans, local police officers directed traffic at the scene of the lynching, trying to afford every person present an equal chance to view the event. Now, this is the sort of lawlessness that was taking place in Tulsa, where, as you have heard in this documentary, there was extremely high unemployment. This was right after World War One. There was no longer as great a demand for oil, Oklahoma being oil territory, no longer as great a demand for oil. Many whites were unemployed, many people had come from other parts of Oklahoma into this urban community, which is the only way that you could possibly find some kind of employment, some kind of part-time job, as the case might be. So you had a very large, unemployed, young, disaffected population of many young whites who were extremely offended by the success of this Black Wall Street, this Greenwood section of Tulsa, with these 8,000 to 10,000 black people who constituted the most prestigious black community in the United States at the time. So that was the socioeconomic and political context within which these events occurred. Now, it is 20 minutes after the hour. We are, as I said, in the final hour of the program. We have 40 minutes remaining. We are going to return to more of this documentary. But can I get 10 additional calls right now? Can I hear from 10 of you right now who value this history, who believe who share our conviction that this 90th anniversary of the Tulsa race riot, the worst race riot in American history, is as good a time, as propitious an opportunity as any to become a member of WBAI if you are not yet so, or to renew your membership, or to simply make an additional contribution to this radio station so that we can keep this history alive and we can make sure that this history does not disappear, that this history does not once again disappear or perish from the face of the earth. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Can I hear from you in Brooklyn? Can I hear from you in Queens? We've been hearing from our listeners in Far Rockaway, quite a few of you in Far Rockaway, and that's a really encouraging sign. Thank you very much indeed. Can we hear from you now in Richmond Hill and in Jamaica, Queens? Can we hear from you now in neighboring Connecticut? What about you in Rockland County and in Orange County and in Westchester County? What about you in Nassau County and in Suffolk County, in Huntington, in Montauk, in Ronkonkoma, in Valley Stream, in Elmont, in all over Long Island? 212-209-2950 is the number. We need to hear from you now, because this history, as you heard, the documents relating to this riot and the immediate aftermath of that riot disappeared, vanished from the state archives in Oklahoma. It was not until 1997 when the Oklahoma legislature created a commission to study that event, that these facts were revealed to the public. It was not until then, not until the final report of the Legislative Commission, a report that was released at the end of February of 2001, a report that uncovered new information and detailed for the first time the extent of the involvement by the state and city government in Oklahoma and in Tulsa in both prosecuting the riot and erasing evidence of that riot. The fact that state officials and people who were in law enforcement had became themselves participants in the violence and even deputized and armed many whites who were part of the mob that killed and looted and burned down the Greenwood area. All of that history was only recently recovered. And we want to be able to make sure that that history is never again disappeared. So your support is what is going to make that possible. Please call us, 212-209-2950. Your $100 pledge of support to WBAI gets you this documentary. In the remaining 37 minutes of the program this afternoon, we still need 45 of you to call. 45 calls, beginning with yours, 212-209-2950. Let's return to more of the documentary, and while the presentation is in progress, please continue to call. Remember, just make a pledge of support at whatever level is convenient and comfortable for you. There are three of you on the line at the moment. We have 12 additional lines available, 212-209-2950, and we thank you very much for your support.
This wouldn't be the first time they gave out reparations for mistreating somebody. See, and if truth be said, that America owed something to everybody in America, because everybody in America helped build it. Whatever the contribution was, it's not just the Rockefellers and the Hearst and the big peoples that build and make this big money and you hear about them, but it's the people that's down you don't hear about, and sometimes you don't see them.
Back in Tulsa, the city finally recognized the Americans who had lost family and property due to government action or inaction. But they didn't get reparations, college scholarships, or even an apology for surviving the worst race riot in American history and 80 years of racism. Instead, they got a shiny brass medal.
I never learned what the medal stood for. We weren't getting what the medal was supposed to be standing for.
It's sad that it's taken 75 years for anybody to even mold a medal to give the survivors. And not only that, but the question, when it comes to reparations, people always think of money, some monetary value. But we don't have a problem with sticking money into molds of brass or clay or whatnot. We don't really need any more monuments for the survivors. There are people, we know that they exist, we know what they came through and those types of things. However, we need for them some type of reparation that will make them happy and satisfied, not ourselves.
This medal, which says that it's a medal of distinction, Oklahoma Medal of Distinction, survivor of the 1921 race riot. So, in a way, it's an admission that our country was not all paradise. And I thought that was important.
It was more than about whether or not they get a gold medal, whether they get an apology, or how much money they get. It's about justice.
Well, the government was standing by when they were destroying our community. There was no police. The fire department didn't answer any calls. And the flame just enveloped our whole community. And we had to run for our lives. I expect to be treated fairly.
The grand jury report basically attributes the actions of about 80, 85 people to an entire community of 10,000 based on their race. The people who showed up with the guns down at the courthouse to try and prevent the perhaps lynching of Dick Rowland, and who ended up in a gunfight down there, they might have brought it upon themselves.
I think the people that have to get over the Tulsa riot are the Larry Simmonses of the world. It's those who would like to forget and ignore what happened and never put it in context that there does have to be an acknowledgement so that there can be a movement forward in a meaningful manner. There's just no excuse, in my judgment, for that approach at this time in life.
We're pleased with the result, obviously, that he understood the statute of limitations issues the same way that we had urged him to. I think the judge has gone out of his way to suggest that there should be something done, but at the same time to acknowledge that the courtroom is not the place to place blame for events that happened over 80 years ago.
Despite being intimidated and denied a fair trial for more than 80 years, the city and state portrayed the victims as having slept on their rights, and the judge agreed. They had gone from justice delayed to justice denied, this time on a technicality that the statute of limitations had expired.
I can't even remember who it was, but one of them was saying, well, he's here. People have been sitting on their rights. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I don't know, I just think that the lawyers for the city in particular just didn't really grasp the enormity of the claims and the feelings in the community and never took it particularly seriously.
The survivors here, they were kids back in 1921. And you can imagine what would that be like for a kid who is attacked, or they see their parents shot and killed, or their home burnt down, and their entire community destroyed.
My grandparents owned a lot of property there too on Archie, just above Greenwood. And everything that was on that property there was burnt down.
Well, that kind of devastation, I mean, that can create tremendous fear and intimidation. If you look at the testimony here, a lot of times the passage of time is what actually enabled people to come forward. They were very afraid and for years and years did not feel comfortable being able to come forward and tell their story. I represent that little kid back in 1921 who didn't have a chance to win. Why should we care more about protecting the interest of a government which is guilty over the interest of innocent victims and their interest in justice. That makes a mockery of our legal system.
The courts were so biased against African Americans in Oklahoma between 1921 and sometime during the 30s that no African American could get fair access to the courts, even if they managed to get the complaint filed. So the idea that our clients slept on their rights is not true, and the clock should continue to be stopped because not even a diligent plaintiff could find the necessary information.
1921 to 1924 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you had the Klan in total control. The Klan controlled virtually every elected office, a lot of company ownerships and everything else.
The police department that was supposed to protect them didn't protect them, and the state, the National Guard that should have come in and restored order didn't. And the city, in fact, deputized large numbers of people to go in and murder and burn houses down and you know, burglarize and take away their property. And the judge, I'm afraid, simply said, well, it was a terrible thing that happened, and the city and the state have a moral responsibility, but he could not find that the legal responsibility existed after so long.
You know, as a result of what happened, as a result of speaking out in Tulsa, those black men going to the sheriff saying no more lynchings, as a result of speaking out against terrorism, the community was wiped out. I mean, you know, so nothing's been done about that.
But to go and just burn people's homes down without any cause, they didn't have any reason for burning our homes down. The shoot in Tulsa, the oil capital of the world, I just think some the city, the state, at least should have done something about it.
All this property up here belonged to my grandparents. But they don't run this freeway right over it. And they haven't given us nothing for it.
We had a cover-up by the government that wasn't disclosed until the Tulsa Commission report came out in 2001. We have seen other cases where the courts have made exceptions because of that very reason.
Statute of limitations aren't for people who have been aggrieved. They're for people who were the aggriever. That's what they're all about, and that's what a lot of the system's about, is a defense bar.
If you look at the programs that our various governments have set up, for example, the program for the Japanese internment camp survivors, what mattered to them, the survivors or the internment camp survivors said, was that the government came forward and said, we're going to take responsibility for that now, we're going to apologize, we're going to give you money, and we're going to say that we're sorry. And it's that, it's a redemptive or restorative justice. It's a process that we were hoping could take place here. And when you hear the attorney for the city of Tulsa come forward and say, these people sat on their rights for 83 years, you know, you just say, what universe are you living in?
Accused of destroying their own community, they knew seeking justice would be impossible, but still they tried. The victims filed more than 100 lawsuits, but the state legal system was made up of the same kind of people who ran Tulsa. Every one of the lawsuits failed.
But then the issue was, what were these people doing for 83 years? What was the African American community in Tulsa concerned with? The African American community survived the atrocity and the tragedy of the riots. Then they had to survive the atrocity and tragedies of the Klan. Then they had to survive the atrocity and tragedies of Jim Crow. Then they had to survive the atrocities and tragedies of mass racial discrimination. For 82 years, these people were busy surviving.
They had one last chance for justice, one place they hadn't tried.
This case is important because not only was there a riot where people were killed, businesses burned down, a whole community destroyed, but it almost was left out of history,
yes.
Not documented,
yes.
Passed over, forgotten, wiped out. But because of Professor Ogletree and his commitment, now there will be justice for survivors. I certainly believe that we're going to win on this.
The Tulsa community had a Black Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
The Tulsa community had businesses, that was destroyed. And America would not acknowledge that they had that. Mm-hmm. America can no longer deny that they have to repair the damage done to us.
On the coldest day of 2005, the dream team of lawyers and survivors went to Congress and the Supreme Court in the pursuit of justice.
All from the Indians, welcome to pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled a plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain.
We know it's cold. We know it's winter in America, but we know there's sunshine coming.
Yes.
There's justice coming.
Yes.
And that it may have taken 84 years, but now is the time for the people of Tulsa to finally recognize we will not tolerate the injustice that has happened to so many black people. We had 150 clients when we filed this lawsuit 2 years ago. 24 have died since then. They're dying every day, every week, every month. But the spirit of Otis Clark, 102, is what's keeping this movement alive and keeping this cause alive, because we're going to keep fighting every single day until there's justice in this court, justice in this country, and justice for every single past, present, and future survivor from the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot. So, Mr. Clark, you ready to take your brief to the Supreme Court?
I am.
All right.
And ain't nobody fighting, cause nobody knows what to say. And ain't nobody fighting, cause nobody knows, nobody knows.
Days after the filings, the survivors suffered a major setback. They lost their most famous lawyer.
God is good. The question is simply, do you know Johnny Cochran? Do you really know Johnny Cochran? When people think about Johnny Cochran, we think about the celebrity, the newspapers, the television cameras. And we know when Michael Jackson called, Johnny said, "Send me." When O.J. called, Johnny said, "Send me." When Geronimo Pratt called, Johnny said, "Send me." When P. Diddy called, Johnny said, "Send me." When everyone called, Johnny said, "Send me." But that's only a part of Johnny Cochran. If that's the only Johnny Cochran you know, you don't know Johnny Cochran. Because he was there for the AJs and the BJs and the CJs and the DJs and the PJs, whose names will never be on any card, who will never be in the press, who will never be known. Those are the people who Johnny Cochran loved and fought for every single day. If you know Johnny Cochran, you will know that the only word that hasn't been mentioned today is the word reparations. When that battle started, when we started defending the black people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Black Wall Street, victims of the 1921 race riot, I went down there. The first lawyer I called was Johnny Cochran. He said, "Count me in." Not for the press, not for the glory, not for the fame, but to help people who have been suffering from 80 years from an unjust system.
On May 12, 2005, the United States Supreme Court refused to hear the case of the Tulsa survivors.
You know, I was worried about the effect this was going to have, especially on the elderly survivors whose, I think, hopes have been raised a great deal in the last few months, and who felt, who had a great deal of confidence in members of the legal team and sort of the group of sort of legal talent that Professor Ogletree assembled. And I think many of them had raised expectations. And I thought immediately of them, that I thought many of them would find it sort of to be a cruel disappointment.
Japanese reparations were paid as a result of an act of Congress. And the same thing could happen here if the state of Oklahoma acting through its legislature, was to provide for reparations to the survivors of the 1921 riot. But as far as going to court and proving that I was the victim of police misconduct or an assault and battery or something that occurred 80 years ago, the court's saying we can't handle that kind of case, too old.
So it was just declined. And a statute of limitation, I guess that's the law, and I can't argue with the law. But, like I said, I've learned how to roll with the punches and get the best out of life I can. So this is just another setback. See, we've been waiting for all these years just to get a chance to get it out in the open. It's never been out in the open like it is now, because there wasn't nobody to tell it to.
212-209-2950. It has never been out in the open as it is now. That from Wes Young, who is practically a baby among the survivors. At the time this documentary was made, he was 91 years old. Practically a baby. The Eminos Gris of the survivors is unquestionably Bishop Otis Granville Clark, who is now 108 years old and was in England giving a talk just earlier this month, and the struggle continues. The struggle continues, the effort is sustained, and the search continues for some form of reparative justice for these survivors of the worst race riot in American history, Tulsa Race Riot or Pogrom of 1921. Somehow there must be some form of justice for these survivors before they die. In 13 days, on May 31st of this year, it would be the 90th anniversary of that event. This afternoon, WBAI is keeping that history alive as only we can. And we ask you to support our ability to continue to do that, to keep this history alive, and to make sure that this history will never again be disappeared or excised from the public consciousness. But we can do that only with your support. No other radio station is going to do it, and we rely on your support to make that possible. 212-209-2950. Your $100 tax-deductible contribution to WBAI this afternoon gets you that documentary, Before They Die. It's a 1.5 hour documentary. You get that documentary Before They Die with your pledge at the $100 level. Just let me say this as well, that the ten copies of Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall's U.S. Constitution and African American Context, they are long gone. So you wouldn't be able to get those. They are long gone. That was a one time thing, a one shot deal. This documentary, Before They Die, continues to be available, and we ask you to call us now at 212-209-2950. We're joined in studio by Program Director Tony Bates. Good afternoon, Mr. Bates.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hamilton, Mr. Haskins. Indeed, Hugh, the point that he was making is important. There was nobody to tell. The story was not out in the open because there wasn't a voice like WBAI to trumpet the story, to put it forward. And we have a unique opportunity, being the station that we are, being a community station, to bring this kind of history, this kind of story back to the light and to share it with our audience as we are doing here this afternoon. We've got to raise about another $3,000 in this last 15 minutes of the hour, folks, for us to reach our goal. That means that we need to hear from you. This is Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. This is a show that we ask, as I've told you before, to raise some of the bigger amounts of money during the day, and because it has a bigger audience and because it has a faithful following. So we ask you now to do your part and to make that phone call, pledging at the $100 level, to receive Before They Die, this film that brings our history back to the fore. And I'm so proud, Hugh, that we can present this kind of history in another document like this in the fund drive, that with hidden history and the ability to hide this in mass and to excise it from history is what has what's happened when a system is filled at the top with people who simply don't want others to know, who are trying to hide, and who did successfully, actually, hide this. It was intentionally removed from the history books. And as you'll see in the DVD, folks, even the folks there that live in Tulsa now are ashamed of bringing this up or of having a conversation about it. It is still a touchy, touchy subject there. But it is not here at WBAI, and we want you to have a copy of this in your home. 212-209-2950 is the phone number to call. A $100 pledge of support to WBAI, and we will send this document out to you. Before They Die is the film. A fascinating, fascinating piece of work.
Indeed. 212-209-2950. It is there in the public record, in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Conyers introduced a bill, the John Hope Franklin Tulsa Greenwood Race Riot Claims Accountability Act of 2009. In that legislation, it says they very clearly in the legislative findings that state and local governments suppressed or ignored issues and claims arising from the 1921 riot, effectively excising it from collective memory. Further, it says that it was not until after the Oklahoma Legislative Commission convened and issued a report in 2001 that it was revealed, quote, the extent of involvement by the state and city government in prosecuting and erasing evidence of the riot. 212-209-2950. We are making sure that that evidence can no longer be suppressed. And what's more, we are making sure, we are standing with these survivors in making sure that there is some public recognition of what they have endured and that they are entitled to some form of reparative justice.
And indeed, One Day in May is the campaign that the creator of this film, Reggie Turner, they have a campaign. They want everybody to take a day in May to recognize these folks, to remember these survivors, and to remember our history. And that's why we've brought this before you folks. This is us doing our part, our remembering of this and restoring this story. You know, when you give folks that story of black people as merchants, as attorneys, as doctors, the history looks very different than the images that we're often assigned in mainstream history.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's another part of this, the excising of this from memory. Because when you look at that, I mean, of course, it's an embarrassment as well that a pogrom took place and that the city officials were involved in assisting with it, surely. But I am always torn by this, the lack of any kind of, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, Hugh, it isn't support, but the fact that our history has been yanked from us when it is positive is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
When there are positive images of black folks, that's often just not available. And these people were the most affluent black community in the country. And that's why they called it Black Wall Street. And that, too, was taken when the story was taken. 212-209-2950. We have a couple of callers on the line. That's not enough for us to get to our goal. We need you to join those people who are calling now in to pledge your support. It's only a $100 pledge. The DVD is called Before They Die. It is about the pogrom that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And again, there are survivors. This brother's 108 years old. And you said
108 years old.
And
that's
I'm sleeping
right.
in on fun drive days. You know what I'm saying?
I'm telling you. I mean, this guy, he is possessed of an energy and a level of inspiration. It's amazing. Otis Granville Clark. But this Greenwood community that we're talking about here by 1921 have become the most prestigious black community in America, incorporating, as you correctly pointed out a moment ago, 35 blocks of homes, 21 restaurants, 30 grocery stores, 2 movie theaters, banks, numerous churches, a hospital, libraries, pool halls, its own bus and cab systems.
Wow.
The dollar circulated 36 times before leaving this community. So you recognize then, and this is an event that is taking place at a time when in much of Oklahoma there is a deep depression because the war is ended. There is no longer a demand for oil in the way that there was during the war. There are large numbers of disaffected whites who are unemployed and who have no prospects, and they're looking at this Black Wall Street. And this is a very important part, as Walter White reported for The Nation in June of 1921. This is a very important part of the animus which leads to this pogrom, the worst race riot in American history, and leading to the largest displacement of American homeowners until Katrina.
That's right.
212-209-2950 is the number to call. We're 10 minutes away from the top of the hour, and we need to make those to get that $3,000. We need now still another $2,200. We can do that. I know we can do that. Yes, we can. But we can only do it with your support, with your help, with your involvement. 212-209-2950. Mr. Michael G. Haskins, you're regaling us here with some gospel.
A little bit of gospel. As we approach the top of the hour, it's been wonderful to hear this and to see this, see the images, and you will get the images when we send you this DVD as a thank you gift for supporting Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton Before They Die. It's a pledge of $100. We'll send that out to you. Remember to make your pledges using Visa card, MasterCard, or American Express. We have some thank you, thank yous. We may not get around to that this afternoon because we need to have at least another 12 calls coming in right now for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. So we have to take advantage of all of these about 8 minutes we have. 212-209-2950. Thank you for those calls coming in. Let's take care of this business now. Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton on 99.5 FM WBAI. Thank you so much for those calls. Please continue to call.
Indeed. 212-209-2950. Now, even as we are speaking, this documentary is still rolling. It's 1.5 hours. And I'm looking here now at images of a congressional hearing on this issue. This is an issue that was brought to the U.S. Congress. Why? Because after 2001, when the Legislative Commission from Oklahoma issued its report, immediately the survivors went to court. And they said, well, look, this history is now out. There's now documented evidence and proof of what happened. We are here now to seek some form of redress. The court said, no, you're about 80-something years too late.
What were you doing because for those 82 years? Yeah. How come you didn't bring this forward in that time?
Exactly, because there's a 2-year statute of limitations. So the survivors are saying to them, but look, understand this. The commission report itself says that this history was deliberately hidden. The documents were removed from the public archives. This is the first time that we now have the information on which to base a claim before the court. What is this about a 2-year statute of limitations? The court said, well, you know, tough noogies. It's you're 2 years, you're 83 years too late. So this is where Johnny Cochran and Charles Ogletree and these other legal luminaries got involved, and they approached Congress, Congressman Conyers, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congressman Gerald Nadler here from New York, Congresswoman Jackson Lee from Texas. They got together and introduced this bill that would essentially reopen an area, a space in time, a 5-year period in which these survivors could introduce a claim. But what happened? That bill was allowed to die. That was introduced in the 111th Congress in April of 2009. That Congress has now expired. It's a 2-year term, which means that somebody now has to reintroduce that and start all over again. In the meantime, these survivors are dying. When this thing started, there were 150 survivors. The last time I spoke with Professor Ogletree, there were fewer than 40 survivors remaining. And since then, others have died.
That ain't even that much to pay out. Get with it. 212-209-2950. That's really amazing, Hugh, because really the folks are experiencing, at the end of their lives, still no justice. And it's a sad part of the history of this country and the way black folks have been treated throughout the history of this country. 212-209-2950. That's the phone number that you're going to call to make your pledge of support to WBAI. You're going to thank us with your donation for keeping this kind of history alive and for bringing this story to our airwaves. airwaves. We're very proud to bring this story to our airwaves because these people, these elders in this DVD, deserve that consideration. They deserve to have their stories told from coast to coast. And that is what we're doing here today on Talk Back. And that's what your dollars support. That's the only reason we've been able to do this, folks, is because of you and your pledges of support to this radio station. 212-209-2950. Just 5 minutes left. A minute ago, Michael, you asked for 12 callers. We got two of them. We've got to get 10 more people onto these phone lines to complete that and to get to our goal. You'll be the next person to make that phone call.
And you know something, Tony? Aren't you so glad that you have a radio station in the middle of the FM dial in New York City to be bringing this information to you? Aren't you glad you have a program like Talkback that comes your way 4 days a week from 3 to, until 5 p.m., bringing you this kind of information? We're able to bring you these long formats because of you and thanks to you. 212-209-2950. Thank you for that call coming in.
We'll
talk back with you, Hamilton.
Indeed, and thank you very much, Michael G. Haskins. Thank you very much to you who are on the line right now. We still need another 11 of your calls in the next 4 minutes or so. Another 11 calls coming up at 6, the award-winning WBAI Evening News. And in these 4 minutes between now and then, well, it's really only about 2.5 minutes in real radio terms for us. We've got to be out of here, but we need you on the line right now, 212-209-2950 from Westchester County, from Rockland County, from the five counties here in New York City, from Connecticut and from New Jersey in Rockland and Westchester. Come on, you're underrepresented here so far this afternoon. 212-209-2950. Tomorrow is the birth anniversary of Malcolm X, and here again, WBAI is going to be a singular voice on the radio dial in terms of the way in which we are going to approach and the way in which we are going to feature the philosophy, the perspective, the voice, the life, the experience, the scholarship of Malcolm X, and that is what you are pledging for. 212-209-2950, so that we will be here for you again tomorrow.
That's right. 212-209-2950. Your pledges allow us to be here tomorrow. Your pledges create WBAI. Every time you pledge your money, this station takes another breath, another deep breath that perpetuates the life of WBAI. 212-209-2950. We have about 2 minutes left, folks, about a minute and a half left, actually, for you to make your call. Pledge at the $100 level to receive before they die. This is Talkback. This is WBAI. You know how we do this. We don't have commercials on this station. We rely upon you, our audience, to bring us up to each of these goals, these thresholds that we try to reach in each hour of the program. It is through you that we're able to keep this radio station going. So make the choice to make that phone call and pledge your support to the station. 212-209-2950. Just a $100 pledge to receive some hidden history. That is the DVD, Before They Die. Be a part of making WBAI happen. 212-209-2950.
Indeed, and please continue to call 212-209-2950. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. This year, in 13 days, will be the 90th anniversary of the worst race riot in American history, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. Let's make sure that there is some recognition and that there is some form of reparative justice for the survivors before they die. Thanks to you. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer, director of incidental music. Thanks to Tony Bates, program director. I am Hugh Hamilton. Thank you, and thank you again. We'll see you tomorrow right here at 3. Looking forward, the good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
On Friday, May 20th at 7 p.m., the Brecht Forum welcomes Angela Davis to Riverside Church. Some 40 years after uprisings in Attica and her own arrest, Angela Davis comes to Harlem to build bridges around issues of austerity, prisons, and global resistance. During this critical evening of teaching and protest, hear Davis speak alongside fellow activists Ruth Gilmore and Vijay Prashad,
accompanied by the Mahina Movement. That's Angela Davis, presented by the Brecht Forum on Friday, May 20th at 7 p.m. Riverside Church is located at 490 Riverside Drive, between 120th and 122nd Streets. For more information, visit brechtforum.org. That's B-R-E-C-H-T forum.org. Or call 212-242-4201.
And it's 6 p.m. in New York City. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org. The phone lines are still open, so you can make your calls to WBAI 212-209-2950. It's 6 p.m. in New York City. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.
Good evening. In the news tonight, a New Jersey town is calling for a ban on hydraulic fracturing. A legal issue brief by a former head of the ACLU says virtually all of the stop-and-frisk encounters with New York police are illegal, and a coalition of anti-hunger groups has joined labor organizations in calling for passage of the New York City Fair Wages Act. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Wednesday, May 18th, 2011. The Highland Park Borough Council in New Jersey passed a resolution last night calling for a statewide and national ban on the controversial gas drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing. The resolution followed a recommendation from its Board of Health. Drilling for natural gas in the Marcellus Shale, a geological formation that runs under parts of New York and Pennsylvania, requires mixing millions of gallons of water from the Delaware River. The process has resulted in leaks and problems with wastewater. According to environmentalists, drilling in these two states could affect the quality of New Jersey's water supply for 3 million residents. Highland Park becomes the first town in the country to call for not only a state but national ban on fracking. It's the first Middlesex County town to join three other New Jersey communities to oppose fracking out of concern for public safety and the effects on water quality and threats to aquifers. WBAI's Rebecca Miles spoke to Jamie Balancia, local coordinator for Food and Water Watch, who is applauding the city council's members for taking such a strong stand.
Well, Highland Park has set an example as the first community in the country to call for a national ban on fracking. The Food and Water Watch organization worked very closely with the Highland Park Board of Health, which was very enthusiastically supported this resolution and brought it before the council.
You said national there. Did you mean a statewide ban or a national ban?
A national ban. Highland Park is really setting a precedent for a national ban on fracking. Now, currently, there are bills before the New Jersey Senate and Assembly to ban fracking within the state, and it's our hope that municipal resolutions like the one that Highland Park has passed will help to strengthen these measures. But we certainly are pushing for a national ban as well.
The resolution is the equivalent to an agreement. It's not legally binding. Where's the mayor's take on this?
The mayor appeared to be very much in support of this last night. He was part of the council meeting that passed it.
Right. So what happens now this resolution has been passed?
Well, in some sense, it's a solidarity measure. Highland Park has shown that it is officially recognizing that fracking is a threat to public health and the integrity of our water supply. Pittsburgh recently prohibited fracking within city limits, which is also an important measure to take, but it's a bit different. We actually would like to see more support, like the kind of support that Highland Park has shown to oppose fracking in other municipalities.
Right. Now, this is the first time I've heard any reference to sort of public health. What were the arguments made about public health with this resolution?
The process of fracking depletes local water sources and produces chemical-laden wastewater. But of greater concern is the fact that thousands of households have been impacted by water contaminated by chemicals and methane, with some actually able to light their tap water on fire due to the extent of the contamination. In places like Highland Park, where fracking isn't actually occurring nearby, it's important that they at least recognize that water supplies are at stake when this process is used.
Are you working with any other borough councils to pass similar resolutions?
Well, right now we are trying to build a grassroots movement to have other municipalities pass similar resolutions. Actually, on foodandwaterwatch.org /fracking, we have available for download kits that have instructions and petitions and all sorts of examples, and we can help people to pass similar resolutions.
I remember reading about Pittsburgh, but city council passing this ban within the city limits, and then I heard about Buffalo and New York also doing the same thing, because there was a consideration at one point that Buffalo would take the wastewater from some of the drill sites. Do you know of any other cities or boroughs that are considering resolutions and legislation right now?
Oh, I believe that there are others. Forgive me, I don't have them ready offhand.
So in New Jersey, I know there's certainly a Senate bill that would implement a state ban. Where are those discussions at the moment?
There's a Senate bill and an Assembly bill to ban fracking within the state of New Jersey. They're still under consideration.
Right. And what about on a congressional level? What legislation is pending there, and where are those discussions now?
Well, at the moment, there is an exciting piece of legislation that's been proposed called the FRAC Act. The FRAC Act's purpose would be to close a loophole in drinking water regulations. Currently, drilling operations are not subject to many of the same drinking water regulations that other processes are. The FRAC Act would seek to close those loopholes.
Jamie Valencia is a local coordinator with Food and Water Watch. She spoke with WBAI's Rebecca Miles. Every year, New York City police stop and frisk hundreds of thousands of people, mostly young Black and Latino men. The NYPD says these searches are to get guns off the street, but in fact, they find very few guns. Instead, they end up arresting more than 50,000 people a year for marijuana possession, which is only a crime if the marijuana is in plain view. Ira Glasser is president of the board of directors at the Drug Policy Alliance and former national executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's written an issue brief outlining the constitutional standards for stop and frisk, and he says virtually all of them are illegal. According to Glasser, a number of Supreme Court rulings say under the Fourth Amendment, there's only one legally justifiable reason for frisking someone.
And that is if the cop has some reasonable basis to suspect that there's a concealed weapon, that this weapon could put the police officer in danger. It can't be a hunch. It can't be that they don't like the way the person looks. It can't be that they're loitering or hanging out. It has to be what the court called articulable facts to form a reasonable basis to suspect that there's a gun concealed on the person that they're talking to. And if that exists, then they're allowed to pat them down. Not allowed to search their bags, not allowed to put their hands in their pockets, but they're allowed to pat them down in order to see if there is a gun there. And if they feel anything else, they can't do a further search. It just has to be for a weapon. And the reason why the issue brief says that most of the frisks are probably illegal is because the police frisk close to 300,000 people a year, about half of all the people that they stop. And they find guns in less than a quarter of a percent of the cases. So that means that 99.75% of the frisks do not turn up guns. And if that's true, the police doing these frisks are either wildly incompetent or they don't have legal justification to do a pat-down. They're doing it for some other reason, and it's illegal. The second thing is that in order to do a fuller search, that is to look through somebody's bag, or to put your hands in their pockets, or to force the person to show the contents of a bag or a briefcase or the pockets, they basically have to have enough reason to arrest them. If they have less than that, then they can't do a full search. And yet, the examples are legion of the number of searches they do. And again, the 600,000 stops, many of which result in full searches, have produced very small percentages of arrests. So that has to mean that these searches are going on in ways that do not satisfy what the Supreme Court has said the legal justification for a search is, and that they're basically stopping kids, young black and Latinos predominantly, 85% to 88%. And yet they're producing almost no weapons and very few arrests, but they are producing 50,000 marijuana arrests a year, also predominantly black and Latino. And the possession of a small amount of marijuana in your pocket is not a crime in New York. It's only a crime if you take it out of your pocket or if you're smoking it. And the way the cops are doing this is they're either putting their hands in these people's pockets, which is illegal, or they're intimidating them into emptying their pockets by making them believe that something bad will happen to them if they don't cooperate, which is not true. It's probably the most systematic example of police lawlessness directed against minorities of any that I can remember outside of the South 50 years ago.
This has been going on for several years now, and as you've said, the numbers top 500,000 a year who are stopped and over 300,000 who are frisked or searched. Why is this still going on? That seems like more than enough for a huge class action lawsuit.
Well, there is a lawsuit. The New York Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit. The Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a lawsuit. These lawsuits are pending. They get buried in factual disputes because most of the people who are stopped and frisked and searched are glad to get out of the police clutches. They don't know their rights, and it's very difficult to find them and to get systematic testimony from them about what the cops did, or to have independent witnesses see what the cops did. So it's a very laborious, factual business. This kind of a report and the sorts of facts that have been publicized over the last year or so are building up a mountain of factual evidence that leads, I think, inescapably to the conclusion that what the cops are doing is not only illegal but racially targeted. And when you say, why is this going on? Well, this started under Mayor Giuliani, and Bloomberg has continued it. And it's based on the theory, if you go into minority neighborhoods and harass enough young black and Latino males, you'll reduce crime, because these are high crime areas, and this sort of puts an intimidating police presence in it. That may or may not be true. There's no real evidence to suggest that it's true. But even if it is true, it's illegal. If you hang them all, you'll get the guilty. And what they're doing is that they are creating massive numbers of criminal records, predominantly against minorities, for no justifiable reason and for no legal reason.
One of the main reasons that police put down as a justification for a stop and frisk is something that they call furtive movements. They observed the suspect acting furtively. Within the last few days, the Supreme Court has ruled 8-1 that police can enter a premises without a search warrant if they hear evidence being destroyed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the only one to object to this, saying that they had just handed the police a very powerful weapon. Is this the equivalent of saying furtive sounds are now justification for a search without a warrant?
I think it will lead to that, because what it means is a cop can come to your door and they can say that they heard sounds and they can say that they smelled smells. And the whole idea of the Fourth Amendment and the requirement of a warrant is to prevent the police from deciding themselves when it's okay to search. Because if you allow the police the discretion to decide when to search, they will abuse their authority and they will search whenever they feel like it. The whole idea of a warrant is that you have to go to a judge and present real evidence before you can get the legal authorization to search. The interesting thing about that case you just mentioned is that they made a mistake. The person they were chasing into that apartment building was not in the apartment whose door they broke down. He was in another apartment, and they followed him into the apartment building, and then they say they smelled marijuana, and then when they knocked on the door, they said that they heard movements that indicated that evidence was being destroyed. Well, who knows what that means? If the cops can break down your door because they say they heard movements, then the whole purpose of the Fourth Amendment in guaranteeing that a person can do what they want in their home without the police intruding unless there's evidence of a crime disappears.
Ira Glasser is president of the board of directors at the Drug Policy Alliance. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Andrea Sears. A coalition of anti-hunger groups has joined a major labor union to call for the passage in the New York City Council of the Fair Wages for New Yorkers Act. The legislation mandates an hourly wage of between $10 and $11.50 an hour for workers at development projects that have received government financing. It's one of many so-called living wage bills being considered in different cities across the country. Joel Berg is executive director of the New York Coalition Against Hunger, one of the groups calling for passage of the Fair Wages for New Yorkers Act. He spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago.
All the hunger groups in New York City agree that one of the main causes of hunger in New York City is low wages. Minimum wage in New York is $7.25 an hour, equal to only about $14,000 or $13,000 a year, depending on how many hours a week you work. There is no way you can feed your family on that amount of money. So we've taken the very basic position that if you're a corporation getting $100,000 or more of city subsidies, and then the least you can do is pay your workers marginally closer to a living wage. The $10 an hour if you provide health care mandated by this bill, or $11.50 an hour if you don't provide health care.
Mm-hmm. Have you been seeing numbers of people coming to food pantries and that sort of thing who are working but still need to get free food someplace because they can't afford it?
Oh, certainly. The largest single population of families using food pantries in New York are working families. They're either working full-time and just not earning enough to feed their families, or they're working part-time. A lot of people focused on the recession, the statistics of people who were out of work entirely, and that's certainly been devastating. But if you were working 35 hours a week and now you're working 25 hours a week, you've had a huge drop in your purchasing power for food and other basic necessities, and that has been very common throughout the city. And jobs are slowly starting to trickle back for some, and hours are slowly starting to get ramped up for some, but in most low-income neighborhoods of New York, there have been scant signs of recovery.
People who oppose the Fair Wages for New Yorkers Act are making some arguments we've heard in other cities that this will actually cost jobs of low-wage people, and they're saying that if a developer develops a retail space, they're not going to find someone to come in because they're going to be forced to pay more than someone, say, down the street from this development is paying. What's your response to those arguments?
That's just bunk. In the last 100 years, when unions and activists have been agitating for increase in wages, every time the most disingenuous argument made by opponents is, oh, we're really worried about the workers. Bill Clinton tells a story in his autobiography. He once asked a worker who stood to benefit from a minimum wage increase what they thought of that argument that he would lose his job. And the worker said, I'll take my chances. It's bad enough if they came forward and were honest and say, well, we're against these wage increases because we'll have to sell one of our vacation homes, or we'll have marginally less profit. But the really outrageous claim that, oh, this is going to hurt our workers, that's why we're against it, is offensive and false. Another argument they've made is this will deny people food stamps. And we just issued an analysis today at the New York City Coalition Against Hunger showing that's just flat out untrue. For every dollar lost by food stamps, many people are going to get three times as much in a wage increase. Some people are already making too much to get food stamps, so it wouldn't affect them at all. So I just wish people who really oppose this would have the courage to at least admit their true reasons and not make up these really cockamamie, you know, claims that, oh, we're worried our workers are going to get shafted.
So where exactly is this bill in the legislative process? And I understand that one of your things you want to concentrate on is encouraging Christine Quinn, council speaker, to support it.
Yes, the way the bill is now in the process is that it has had a hearing in the city council, and the council speaker has to determine whether it's going to come up for a vote. Christine Quinn, the Speaker of the City Council, has been a true progressive champion on so many causes, from marriage equality to hunger to food access. She's been a great ally of ours, and she has done as much as any elected official in New York to reduce hunger in New York City. So we do hope she also comes around on this vital issue and at least allows a vote.
And in terms of the rest of the members of the council, how's it look for you?
Well, there are a majority of members of the council who have co-sponsored the bill. So if it does come up for a vote, assuming none of those people who co-sponsored don't vote for it, it will pass. My understanding is they're likely a few votes away from a veto-proof majority. It's pretty clear that if they do pass it, the mayor will veto it, and then the fight will be to see whether they have the votes for an override.
And just one last question. Just in general, the importance of the work that your new caucus is embarking on, what's your goal? What do you want to accomplish?
I want to help conservatives understand that if you're against welfare, if you're against food stamps, if you're against public housing, you don't want your tax dollars to be spent on that, then you should support this, because this says we don't need taxpayer dollars to pay people a living wage. We just need the companies that are already getting corporate welfare to pay for it. So if we want to get the, we want to get that message out, and we want to get the message out that people who are working should not be hungry. No one in America should be hungry, but particularly people who are working, playing by the rules, should not be hungry.
Joel Berg is head of the New York Coalition Against Hunger. He was interviewed by WBAI's Jose Santiago. The U.S. Senate was scheduled to vote today on a bill introduced by Republican Senator Mitch McConnell to greatly expand offshore oil drilling and curtail environmental controls. The bill has already passed in the House. And yesterday, the Senate rejected a bill to roll back tax breaks for big oil companies, though a majority of senators, 52 in all, voted in favor of rescinding the tax breaks, which would have brought in some $21 billion over 10 years. They fell short of the 60 required to bring the measure to the floor for a vote. David Goldston, director of government affairs at the Natural Resources Defense Council, says environmentalists are having mixed reactions to yesterday's vote.
We're disappointed that it failed, but we're pleased that it got a majority. It also attracted two Republican senators, Senators Snow and Collins from Maine, which was a good sign that the issue indeed has bipartisan appeal, and we think the issue won't go away. The fact that it got a majority will be one thing that keeps it as a live issue, as will the deficit and the continuing concern over the behavior of oil companies and their profitability.
There is another vote coming up fairly quickly. Mitch McConnell is bringing two of the bills that the House passed that would expand offshore drilling. Which bills are going to make it to the Senate for a vote soon, and what would be the impact there?
Senator McConnell has packaged together two House bills that would require oil leasing almost immediately in the western Gulf of Mexico and in Virginia, and would set a 30-day deadline for review of drilling permits, and then a 60-day automatic approval if the Interior Department hasn't gotten back to the oil companies by then. We think these provisions would actually leave the oversight of oil drilling weaker than it was before Deepwater Horizon. It would force the immediate releasing of important coastal areas before adequate review was done. And there are also provisions in these bills that short-circuit the judicial process. One provision would say that no one could challenge the environmental impact statements that were done related to the Gulf drilling. Yet those environmental impact statements were done before Deepwater Horizon, at a point when people were claiming that such an accident couldn't occur, and they were done by the Minerals Management Service, which was not exactly known for the quality of its environmental reviews. So to basically prevent any challenges to those environmental impact statements especially weakens the ability to provide proper oversight. There are also provisions here that try to stack the deck against anyone who challenges permits in the Gulf by requiring cases to go into the court that is the most favorable historically to oil companies, and by limiting the discretion of judges in deciding what kind of evidence is relevant in a case. So all these things together would expand oil drilling into new areas and also weaken some central elements of the oversight process. There's a third bill that the House passed that goes even further that the Senate has not yet taken up. It's not clear yet whether they will. That bill would open up almost the entire coast, east and west coast of the United States, to oil drilling, Maine to North Carolina and Southern California and parts of Alaska, and would require that half the unleased property be put up every 5 years for leasing. That bill seems to have even caused some consternation in the Senate, so that bill isn't part of the package today. We'll see if it comes up at a later point.
What kind of support do the two bills that McConnell is bringing to the Senate have?
We don't think there's any chance that they can cross the 60-vote threshold, and they may not even be able to get a majority. So we are hopeful that it will be a sign that there really isn't as much energy behind some of this drilling as its proponents would make it appear, and that people understand that this is not a way to affect gasoline prices, that it's not likely to have any impact.
Is there any counter move to this pressure to increase drilling? Is there anyone who is promoting or pushing Congress to act on tighter EPA controls over the whole process at this point?
There are a number of ideas out there for creating additional incentives for alternative vehicles, for example, but the main locus of that fight is really in the administration. So under current law that Congress passed in 2007, the administration can look at further increasing fuel economy standards. They're due to put out a proposal in September. They've already put out a range in terms of the mileage range that they might require. The high end of that is around 60 miles per gallon, which we think is doable and would have an enormous impact on reducing demand for oil, helping with both national security and the environmental side of it, and also at the same time saving Americans money at the gas pump because they would not need to buy as much gas to go the same distance.
Is there likely to be opposition from the oil-producing states and those who are funded by the oil companies to increases in mileage standards?
You know, I think the idea of increasing mileage standards itself is probably, at this point, gotten further acceptance, even in industry. The issue is by how much, and so the auto industry and others will be trying to make the increase as minimal as possible, and so that will be the issue, is the size of the increase. Will it be really as much as we can do and get the maximum benefit for the public?
So what else is on the horizon for energy legislation right now?
For oil, again, which is mostly used for transportation, again, there may be smaller bills looking at ways to promote things like electric vehicles and hybrids and so forth. On the energy generation side, which doesn't affect oil that much, but certainly has other environmental and economic impacts, there are efforts to promote energy efficiency through things like building codes and appliance efficiency standards, as well as efforts to increase the amount of renewable energy we use to generate electricity in the United States, and broad ideas like the clean energy standard that the president proposed in his State of the Union message.
David Goldston is Director of Government Affairs at the Natural Resources Defense Council. This afternoon, the Senate did vote on Mitch McConnell's offshore drilling bill. It was defeated by a margin of 57 to 42, with five Republicans joining the two independents and all but one Democrat in opposing the measure. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 18th, 2011. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago and Rebecca Miles. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, following airstrikes in Darfur, the Sudanese government restricts access to aid agencies.
Often after attacks, we'll see limited access for humanitarian groups because folks don't want the story to get out.
In South Africa, we look at why many people in the township of Mandela Park have refused to vote in today's elections.
Hey, we don't even know whom this person that we are voting.
And Florida's Governor Rick Scott prepares to sign a bill that critics say makes it more difficult to vote. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Treasury Department today announced sanctions against leaders of the Syrian government, citing human rights abuses against anti-government protesters. President Obama signed an executive order freezing the assets of President Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian vice president and prime minister, as well as several other high-ranking government ministers. A United States envoy is meeting with government officials in Myanmar today, the first high-level diplomatic contact since the new civilian government took over. The U.S. has deemed the recent elections seriously flawed. The same officials are in power, just under different titles. But State Department spokesperson Mark Toner defended the visit.
Which is consistent with our two-track approach to Burma. There's nothing Pollyannish about this. You know, we recognize that there's some fairly serious challenges to address in this relationship. But we're going to continue to pursue a dual-track policy that involves pressure but also principled engagement.
The U.S. has been pressuring Myanmar, also known as Burma, to release political prisoners. This week, the junta government began releasing more than 15,000 prisoners under an announced amnesty. The government also said it would rescind death penalties in favor of life sentences and reduce other sentences by a year. But human rights groups say the release does not go far enough. The BBC reports about 30 political prisoners are among those released. Amnesty International says there are currently 2,200 prisoners of conscience in custody, something the government has denied. Human rights groups are also concerned about Myanmar's most famous political prisoner, Aung San Suu Kyi. She recorded and sent a video to the Australian government asking them to keep up international pressure.
We have not seen any positive, definite move towards a truly democratic process.
Audio from Australia's ABC. U.S. Envoy Joseph Yun is expected to meet with Suu Kyi tomorrow during his diplomatic visit to Myanmar. More than 1,000 people protested in northern Afghanistan today after a NATO raid led to the deaths of 4 people, claimed by local officials to be civilians. The demonstrations, which centered on a NATO military post, turned violent. At least 12 people died. Media reports say security forces and police fired live shots to disperse the crowd as it closed in on the base. It's still unclear exactly how the protesters were killed. NATO officials maintain that the 4 killed in the overnight raid were insurgents. An Al Jazeera reporter has been released after being taken into custody in Syria 3 weeks ago. Dorothy Parvaz was transferred from Syria to Iran and questioned there, her fiancé told media. She arrived in Qatar this morning. Mexican police have discovered more than 500 undocumented migrants in 2 cargo trucks in the southern state of Chiapas. Officials say conditions in the trucks were cramped and the migrants suffered from lack of air and water. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
The 513 migrants found crammed into the trailers of 2 18-wheelers Tuesday came from Central and South America, the Caribbean, and Asia. State police discovered the migrants via an X-ray machine at a checkpoint near the state capital of Chiapas. According to statements made to police, each migrant was to pay $7,000 upon arrival in the United States. State police turned over the migrants to immigration authorities, who are processing deportation orders. Thousands of undocumented migrants enter Mexico every week in an attempt to reach the United States, often traveling in dangerous and denigrating conditions. Allegations of corrupt officials are common along the migrant trail. In recent years, organized criminals have muscled into migration routes, setting up smuggling rings, kidnapping for ransom, and trafficking victims into prostitution and forced labor. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
The Department of Homeland Security says that it will allow Haitian nationals living in the U.S. to remain for another year and a half. Currently, about 50,000 Haitians are in the U.S. with temporary protected status, or TPS. This status was granted because of the horrific post-earthquake conditions in Haiti. Homeland Security will also allow Haitians who came to the U.S. in the year following the earthquake to apply for temporary protected status. Until now, TPS has only been available to those who arrived before the disaster, leaving thousands of Haitians fleeing the devastation in immigration limbo. And finally, a federal judge has stepped in and blocked a recent settlement between the Interior Department and Wild Earth Guardians aimed at streamlining Endangered Species Act determinations. The goal of the settlement was to move candidate species forward in the review process, but the Center for Biological Diversity opposed the settlement as being, quote, too weak, too vague, and ultimately unenforceable. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan stayed the agreement until mid-June and told the parties to go back to mediation, including the Center for Biological Diversity, in the talks. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The Sudanese army is carrying out airstrikes in South Darfur, hitting the village of Sukamir Tuesday and Labado and Esheraya on Sunday. The Joint African Union United Nations mission is trying to gather information on casualties and displaced persons. But that might be difficult, as Sudan's government is restricting access to affected areas. Darfur has been the site of intense violence over the last decade, with hundreds of thousands killed and many more displaced. For more on the latest situation, we're joined by Simon Bell, Executive Director of Save Darfur, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
What more can you tell us about these airstrikes?
This is a continuing trend that started in December. As you know, the conflict in Darfur, and there was a genocide for many years in the first part of 2003-2004, included much aerial bombing by the government against villages in Darfur, a very ham-handed counterinsurgency strategy, try to drain the swamp to kill the fish. The fish would be the rebel groups. And we have new momentum in a peace process that's underway in Doha, in Qatar. And we have rebel groups that are starting to come together, make alliances. And so this very well could be an attempt by the government to put a stop to that.
Do you have any news on civilian casualties at all?
I don't have the exact numbers of displacement or death. It's important to know a lot of these airstrikes are very rudimentary in nature. I mean, it's literally people rolling bombs out of the back of a cargo airplane. So it's very hard to do distinction, to distinguish between armed combatants and civilians on the ground. And so it has a... These attacks usually have very bad outcomes for civilians on the ground.
UN aid agencies said today that the government in Sudan told them that they'd be restricting all movement of humanitarian aid agencies in a 15-kilometer radius of Nyala. Can you tell us any more details on that?
This is obviously particular to this incident, but we've seen this in all three regions of Darfur, the continued harassment of humanitarian aid organizations and the continuing obstruction of the government of Sudan to allow humanitarian groups access. And this is really about two things. One, it's about humanitarian aid organizations being the eyes and ears of the international community to report the stories about atrocities that are taking place. And so often after attacks, we'll see limited access for humanitarian groups because folks don't want the story to get out. And then the second thing is about squeezing the IDP communities and some of the communities that are anything that challenges the government. So it's really a unbelievable situation where you have an international community that is willing to go in and provide sort of critical medical and food aid and development assistance, and a government that won't allow its people to have access to those services and doesn't provide them on its own.
Sam Bell, Executive Director of Save Darfur, based in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
Tunisian officials say they'll report Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to the UN Security Council if his forces continue to strike along the border. Libyan troops fired rockets toward Tunisia Tuesday. The border area has been a rebel stronghold and is a supply route for aid, food, and fuel. NATO also continued to bomb targets yesterday, striking tanks, armored personnel carriers, and missile launches near Tripoli and a command and control bunker near Misrata. The Gaddafi regime also released four Western journalists today. Although they received a one-year jail term for being in the country illegally, Libyan officials commuted the sentences. Meanwhile, the United Nations says more than 2 million people need humanitarian aid, and nearly 500,000 have fled their homes. Many of those affected are African migrants, and 1 in 10 have died trying to escape the conflict. UN Radio's Jocelyn Sambira files this report.
There was nothing in the boat, not even anything to eat, even nothing for the children. The boat was old and rotting. We thought it might even sink. We just prayed that we would make it here.
Thousands of migrant workers are arriving in the tiny island of Lampedusa by boat. They board old and rickety boats from the coast of Libya and make the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean. UNHCR estimates 1 in 10 dies on the journey over from Libya. Alex Amadin, a Nigerian migrant worker, is recovering from one of those hazardous boat trips.
3 weeks or 2 weeks plus, I've been locked inside house. Nothing, nowhere to come out, nowhere to get food. Instead not to die in that place, we find ourselves into that boat and run away. So many people, pregnant women, women with children, trying to save their life. We all run into that one boat.
Conditions on the journey are grim. Many of the migrant workers arrive traumatized and exhausted, both from the journey and by a conflict in a country which is not their home. When the migrants arrive on the island, they get shelter and basic support at a reception center. But according to its director, Federico Miragliottia, they need more than practical help.
What we find when we try to help these people is a great deal of anxiety and tragedy. They may not have many possessions, but they have emotional baggage. When we talk to them, we discover there is not just anxiety about the past, but also a need to start a better life. But they don't have the means to start afresh, which is why they need our help.
A little over a week ago, 1,400 people drowned at sea trying to escape the unrest in Libya. But the dangers are not enough to deter others from making this perilous journey. Barbara Molinario is with the UNHCR.
As it has usually been throughout, you know, the 10 years that we've seen landings in Lampedusa, the months where we have most landings are generally July, August, September, and October.
It's thought that over 1,000 people are planning to attempt the crossing from Libya with the next window of good weather. Most will travel in unsafe boats. This means that the sea may claim the lives of many more who only wanted to survive. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
South Africans have been voting in local elections. The African National Congress currently controls 8 of the country's 9 provinces. But some observers say the ANC is facing the strongest opposition since the end of apartheid nearly 30 years ago. Jobs, housing, healthcare, and the delivery of basic services have dominated the campaigning. One place where people struggle to get basic services is Mandela Park, a township of about 20,000 people in Cape Town. In 2009, as a result of a housing crisis in their community, about half the people decided to join the No Land, No House, No Vote campaign. The grassroots movement first started in 2004 and boycotts elections and party politics as a way of drawing attention to the ongoing lack of basic rights and services for poor people. Loiso Mfuku represents No Land, No House, No Vote in Mandela Park. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're not voting on principle, but from what you've observed of the elections taking place around you, has it been a smooth election? Can you describe the scene for us at polling stations around where you are in Cape Town?
From this morning, there were people that went to the voting polls to cast their votes. But in our view, it seemed to be people who are loyal to their political parties. But the general members of the community remain in their own homes. And we, as the movement, we had a march this morning from 7 o'clock, an anti-X march. We use the X as a symbolic meaning for our anti-vote stand.
What candidate is likely to be representing Mandela Park when the votes are counted?
Yes, that is a very good question, you know, because Mandela Park is a very big area. It is big enough to have its own councillor or its own candidate to represent the area, somebody who understands the dynamics of Mandela Park community. But as things stand now, Mandela Park is divided into two, and both the candidates are not from Mandela Park. They are coming from different areas outside Mandela Park. And these people don't understand the dynamics and the issues of Mandela Park. And but because, you know, this is done through party, you know, politics, and the community, is sidelined, we are not happy. I mean, for years, Mandela Park has been treated like this, without its community participating even in municipality processes. And yes, currently, this one big challenge, and people in Mandela Park, even those that I met this morning that went to cast their vote, they were also saying that, hey, we don't even know whom this person that we are voting. We are just told that he's staying somewhere in Khayelitsha. Khayelitsha is actually an area outside of Mandela Park. Yes, people don't know, but they vote. They just vote because they think it's the right thing to do.
How typical is the experience you describe, people in Mandela Park, Cape Town, not knowing their candidates, feeling disenfranchised? Is that typical across South Africa?
Well, across South Africa, on the news, we've been hearing people complaining about the candidates that they do not know, because what is happening is that political parties bring their own list of candidates and impose them, to a particular community without a consultation of that community. So this has been, it's something that characterized these local government elections this year. True that we also feel as activists that maybe this is a start or the beginning of the deeper understanding of what elections are about. Maybe the next elections will show much character, illustrating really the understanding, the deeper understanding of what people really think of politicians. The people are really not happy to have candidates that they do not know, candidates that do not stay where they stay, candidates that they have not elected by, themselves.
So you're encouraging people not to vote, but a lot of the issues that have been the focus of this election are to do with the delivery of basic services like water, housing, jobs. Is that a good sign of what might come after the elections, do you think?
Well, according to the authorities, that's what they believe, or that's what they want us to believe to be the case. But the past 17 years, that we have been part of these voting, processes, we have not seen any of those changes.
What are the top things on the top of your list that you'd like to see changed at Mandela Park?
We would like to engage the president, you know, around this issue of invading land and building our own houses, so that they look at it and legalize it, or find ways that that to allow this process to carry on, you know, but accommodating people that are in need. The other issue is to intervene the serious issue of banks that are evicting people in their own homes. There are many other issues, you know, like electricity and water, which have been cut. Those are the priorities that we would like the president to look into.
Loiso Mfuku from the No Land, No House, No Vote campaign, thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for the moment.
For weeks now, the U.S. House has been debating energy policy, but this week it's the Senate's turn. Two competing partisan bills were debated and both rejected by that body. In Washington, Matt Laszlo reports on where the debate and national policy goes from here.
Soaring gas prices have families economically pinched and businesses hurting, and politicians are looking for ways to respond. Democrats control the Senate, so on Tuesday they went first and offered a proposal to unwind tax breaks for the nation's five biggest oil companies. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who sponsored the bill, says the question facing lawmakers was easy.
A vote on my bill presents, a positive vote on my bill presents a simple choice for everyone in this chamber. Are you on the side of working class families, or are you on the side of big oil?
60 votes were needed to pass the legislation that would have rolled back more than $20 billion in tax breaks for the oil companies. Democrats fell short with just 52 votes. Two Northeastern Republicans supported it, while three oil state Democrats opposed it. The legislation would have used the oil companies' tax breaks to pay down the deficit. Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Democrats should have tried to reduce the price of the pump.
Americans are struggling. My constituents in Kentucky are hurting, and they want relief. And all they're getting from Democrats in Washington is a dog and pony show.
But Majority Leader Harry Reid says unwinding the tax breaks is a down payment at a time when oil and gas companies are reaping massive profits, more than $32 billion last quarter alone.
Of course we have to do something about the exorbitant gas prices, and the best way to start with that is to do something about the five big oil companies getting subsidies they don't need.
According to the Congressional Research Service, repealing the tax subsidies would not affect oil production or gas prices. But Democrats failed to pass the bill, and today Republicans countered. Their proposal, similar to legislation already passed in the House, would force the Obama administration to expedite new leasing permits off the nation's coasts, which McConnell says is necessary to drive prices down.
Our plan would actually do something to increase supply, putting downward pressure on price. As the Democratic senator from Missouri said yesterday, the more supply, the less the price.
Experts say expanding supply wouldn't drive costs down, potentially for years, because it's a timely process. And Democrats are wary of expanding drilling in the wake of the BP oil spill, because Congress never increased regulations. Besides environmental concerns, Democratic Whip Dick Durbin says the GOP bill is just flawed.
I believe the Republican approach to this will be unsuccessful. I believe it overlooks some very fundamental and basic facts. And the facts are these. We cannot drill our way out of our problem. If you take a look at all the known oil reserves in the United States, offshore and onshore, all of them, they comprise 2% of the known oil reserves in the world. 2%.
To defuse Republican attacks, President Barack Obama announced over the weekend that he's reversing his post-BP oil spill policy of halting the extension of all oil leases in the Gulf of Mexico. The president says he's also taking steps to extend offshore leases in Alaska and to offer new leases in the Gulf. But Obama says the nation needs a long-term energy policy that includes solar and a greater focus on fuel efficiency.
These are investments worth making, investments that will save us money, reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and protect the health and safety of our planet. That's an energy policy for the future, and it's what I'll be fighting for in the weeks and months to come.
With both Republican and Democratic bills going down in defeat, it's unclear what the next energy fight will look like. A bipartisan group of senators have introduced a bill to increase efficiency standards in homes, and it's picking up some steam. But that is a long-term proposal that doesn't deal with gas prices. Experts say that means this summer may be an expensive one to take that road trip. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
In Florida, Governor Rick Scott has until Saturday to sign off on a new bill that changes the state's voting policies. Critics say the GOP-sponsored legislation will make it more difficult to vote in the country's largest swing state. From WMNF in Tampa, Sean Kinnan reports.
Following disenfranchisement during the 2000 presidential election, the Sunshine State enacted changes to make voting easier. Lawmakers put into place a system of early voting. It's been very popular, especially among ethnic minorities and registered Democrats. But under the new bill, passed along party lines, the early voting period would decrease from 14 days to 8.
Early voting has been a great success. We have almost half in the last election were cast either by early voting or by vote by mail.
That's Mickey Castor. She's president of the Hillsborough County chapter of the League of Women Voters. They're also concerned about a provision in the 150-page bill that could penalize groups that organize drives to register voters.
We have 48 hours to turn in any voter registration forms that we collect. And if we do not, there is a penalty of $50 per registration form, or a cumulative of $1,000, up to $1,000, and the Attorney General has the potential to bring civil citations against us. So that this caused the League of Women Voters of Florida, our statewide organization, very reluctantly decided that we could not put our members and the organization in that position. It was just too potentially burdensome.
Supporters of the new election bill say it's needed because of election fraud, although only 4 voting fraud arrest warrants have been issued over the last 3 years in Florida. On the Senate floor, Republican Mike Bennett responded to opponents of the bill who said it would make voting more difficult.
We want to make it more convenient. How much more convenient do you want to make it? We want to go to the house, take the polling booth with us? This is a hard-fought privilege. This is something people died for. And you want to make it convenient?
Bennett also said that people in Africa walk 200 to 300 miles to vote, a claim that was rated by the fact-checking website PolitiFact Florida as a pants-on-fire falsehood. If the governor does sign the election bill, HB 1355, into law, Castor says the League of Women Voters may sue.
Yes. We are exploring the possibility of suing the state, and we are very optimistic that if it came to that, that we would prevail. In 06, there was legislation that was very punitive toward third-party registrars like this.
Castor is the stepmother of Democratic U.S. Representative Kathy Castor, but the League is a nonpartisan group. The ACLU is also considering legal action, and Senator Bill Nelson has asked the governor to veto the bill. If he doesn't, Nelson wants the U.S. Justice Department to investigate whether the law will disenfranchise voters. The bill also makes it more difficult for people who have recently changed their names or addresses to update that information at the polling precinct on Election Day. Instead, they would have to fill out a provisional ballot, which receives more scrutiny than a normal ballot and is more likely to be rejected. Sean Kinnan, FSRN, Tampa.
That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. This programming note tonight on Earthwatch with Robert Knight, the very latest from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. That's this evening at midnight right here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York and WBAI.org. It's currently just about 7 o'clock. which means it's time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Oh, Billy Bump, for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood, but Billy Bump.
Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight with jam-packed studio. Why is everybody here tonight? I have no idea what the occasion is.
It's a fundraiser.
Yeah, but that's not the occasion. Is that why everybody came down here for the fundraiser?
Oh, yeah.
It's raining outside, so that everybody, what, came in to get dry? Well, okay, first of all, that's the voice of Red Hack. We have not heard you in a while.
Nope.
And we're not going to be hearing you much today either, because you're going to be down in the tally room taking pledges. So if you want to hear the voice of Red Hack, you can call up and pledge. You might actually get a one-to-one conversation. Mike is here also.
Hi.
Are you going to say anything? Okay.
Hello.
Tom Rhett is here.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Also, I haven't seen you in a while. Voltaire.
Hi.
Jim.
Hello.
Down in Philadelphia is Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
We have Bicycle Mark is here from, what country did you come from this time?
The Netherlands.
Netherlands, okay. Well, sometimes it's Portugal, sometimes it's New Jersey. I never really know with you.
Hi.
Welcome to this country. Not Kevin, you're here from Vermont, right?
Hello, I drove 300 miles from this fundraiser.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard what I have to do. I have to drive all the way to Canada to get my key replaced for the smart car because the battery died. How about that for technology?
That sounds fun.
Isn't that great? Yeah, but you know, I'm just happy to be. Oh, and Bernie S. down in Philadelphia. Did I mention you already?
You did.
I did.
Greetings from Philadelphia again.
Thank you. I'm losing my mind. This was one of those days. I really wanted to be here tonight. I'm glad I made it, but I almost didn't because today was a day I had to pick up a shipment for the Club Mate beverage that we send out, the German energy drink. But we have to put it in boxes, and there's only one place that has the boxes that we can ship it in without it breaking into a million pieces. And that place is in the middle of Queens. And they closed promptly at 4 o'clock, and the only way to get the material to us is into the 2600 van. So I was driving there this afternoon, and in the middle of it, you guys noticed it was raining today? You noticed that, right? It was a monsoon. Well, that's when my windshield wipers decided they were going to fail, and I think the windshield wiper motor just conked out. And there I am in the middle of Queens with no windshield wiper and a monsoon and the place closing in 5 minutes. And I honestly don't know how I made it. I don't know how I did this. This makes no sense to me at all. But somehow I managed to get through that situation and survive because I knew being here tonight was important and raising funds for the radio station mattered.
Yeah. 212-209-2950 if you want to get a jump on things.
Yeah, that's I risked my life. Well, for a number of reasons, but that's just one of them.
I advise our listeners, don't risk your life. If you're driving, like, pull over before you call us.
Well, that's the other thing. When you're driving in Queens, you can't really pull over either because there's no place to pull over. So it was very difficult. I literally had to stick my head out the window to see where I was going at times and go at 5 miles an hour, and it was really kind of pathetic.
Can you imagine the chaos that would have been caused if you called while you were doing this?
No, I was texting while I was doing. No, I wasn't texting. That would be about as bad as it could possibly be. But important thing is, made it here, and we'll get the thing is, when I get the van fixed, I don't have to drive all the way to a different country to get it fixed or to a particular mechanic that has the rights to the part, like today's computerized cars act. It's really ridiculous. I can go to any mechanic and get this fixed, but just not right now. So I want to thank everybody, by the way, for last week. Last week we did tremendously. We raised $4,500 in 2 hours, which is simply phenomenal. We're on for 1 hour tonight, and we're not on at all next week. So this is the last gasp of the fundraiser for us here at Off the Hook. And what we're offering tonight, we'll make it very straightforward and simple. We're offering the same DVD packages of the greatest hits of hope. In other words, 20 talks that many times encompass more than one DVD. So you're getting 20 plus DVDs for a pledge of $75. These are DVDs from three different Hope conferences, and they're all kinds of fascinating talks. And if you want more of the Hope conferences, 40 DVDs will be sent to you for a pledge of $125. We're going to be playing a couple of excerpts, but there's also one other special thing we're doing tonight that we have not done before. And that involves our own Rob T. Firefly, who you may not have known this, but he is somebody who can put together some artwork, some pictures. In fact, he's doing this right now. Rob, can you talk and draw at the same time?
I can. I can also chew gum, but then I'd sound funny.
Yeah, no, don't do that. You're there with a pen and a piece of paper, and you're sketching. Do you mind if I ask what kinds of things you're sketching right now?
I am sketching some telephones.
Okay.
Telephones of all sorts of styles and shapes and sizes, and I'm sketching these on
paper.
I'm sketching these on paper, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, that's
archival quality paper.
Archival quality paper in archival quality inks.
What is archival quality paper?
It means it's acid-free. It's not going to turn yellow and get gross if you want to keep this forever and ever as a wonderful keepsake, which, of course, I think you should.
Okay, all right.
Just to give a little bit more of a description about these, he's not... They're personalized. Some phones are touch dial phones, others are rotary phones, even have broken phone booths. And, of course, they all are, to some degree, off the hook.
Yeah, that's something. So what we're doing tonight, for everybody who calls and pledges any amount, we will send you a picture that Rob is sketching right now in the studio, your own unique, individualized picture. It'll be a surprise. You won't know exactly what it is, but if you want to see the kind of artwork we're talking about, go to robvincent.net. Go there right now. Rob Vincent, robvincent.net.
What a ridiculous name.
And well, you'll see an example. You'll see a few examples of some of the artwork that Rob is capable of producing and is producing right now, even as we speak. He's going to be producing all this during this hour. So the more calls we get, the harder he has to work.
Yes. So if you don't like me and you want to make me work hard, this is your chance.
All right. 212-209-2950. We have actually 20 DVD sets. 20 DVDs. That's in one set. Yes, I'm still a bit flustered here. And basically what you get for that is it's a good look at three of the Hope conferences that have taken place since the first one we're featuring is 2006, Hope number 6. The last Hope in 2008, and the next Hope in 2010. The three most recent conferences, 20 of the biggest hits, the conferences, or the panels, rather, that were well-received. 212-209-2950. What we're going to do now, we're going to play a bit from one of those panels. Bernie, anything you want to say to bring some calls in?
Well, I'd like to know what this panel is.
You would like to know that, wouldn't you? I think the thing that tells us how many calls we have is broken, because there's nothing on the screen here. It's all blank.
I'll say, in addition to my wanting to know what this panel is, because they're all really interesting, is that this radio station is really what you get, WBAI. You get this show, and which most of the time we're not begging on the air. We have to do this to keep the radio station transmitting, or we go off the air and no more Off the Hook and no more dozens of other amazing programs that no other radio station is going to broadcast, in New York or anywhere else for that matter.
Very true.
We have an expensive transmitter on the top of the Empire State Building that reaches four states. And we're on the internet, and all this stuff costs a lot of money to maintain studios. This is not just some folks sitting in the basement on a webcast. This is a real radio station with real people.
Those are real people too. They're just in a basement doing a webcast. But
yeah, I'm talking about. It's not like a what they call DJ farms, where you get people at these commercial radio stations just slaving away like a boiler room. This is a real radio station with people that really create some amazing programming. I'm not necessarily speaking about ourselves, but we do come up with some amazing stuff. And we're going to play some of the stuff that we put together on the Hope conferences over the past few years. And we encourage everybody listening, who obviously values this show, you wouldn't be listening now, to call 212-209-2950 and give us a hand. Help support the station. This is the last night for the fundraiser, and we'll give you an amazing thank you gift of 20 DVDs for $75 and 40 DVDs for $125. That's just amazing value for great entertainment.
It's a lot of DVDs.
I'm posting, as Rob draws, I'm posting some of the drawings to the WBAI Twitter stream. So if you go on Twitter to WBAI_radio, you can see some examples now, and we'll post more examples as the hour goes on.
But how do you see pictures on Twitter?
You click the link.
Click the link. Okay. Yeah. All right. Very good. Yeah. So you can do that. That's one way of doing it. Or you can go to robvincent.net and see Rob's drawings there. But again, everybody who calls 212-209-2950 for this hour only will get their own personalized copy in the mail, and that'll come directly from us. So you'll get it. You'll get it quickly. Definitely get that quickly. The other premiums will follow shortly thereafter. Again, 212-209-2950, 75 for 20 DVDs, 125 for 40 DVDs from the most recent Hope conferences.
Now, I know we say it a lot, but it's something really important to stress. Anyone who really supports freedom of speech, this is the kind of station to pledge to, because the kinds of opinions that you hear come across the station, whether you agree with it or not, is very hard to find anywhere else when you have big corporate sponsors breathing down your neck. You know, whereas here, you can have a lot of very unpopular opinions come out. You could have very interesting ideas that you won't get to even, consider that you don't like. You won't even hear about it. You won't be able to form an intelligent opinion.
Absolutely, absolutely. People take it for granted, I know. These fundraisers are a necessary evil, which keeps it all free and open and exciting. It really is. Go ahead.
I think evil is really overstating the case. They may be obnoxious, but what's really evil is advertisement that you get on the other radio stations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, at least here we're honest with you. This is how we fund ourselves. If you listen to most commercial radio, they pretend to be interested in you, but their customer is the advertisers. And we don't play those kinds of games.
Absolutely not. All right, but this is the kind of game we're going to play right now. We're going to play an excerpt from is this Hope number 6? No, this is The Last Hope. I'm sorry, The Last Hope in 2008. And, of course, it wasn't The Final Hope. It was just the name of the conference. The Last Hope, 2008. This is someone you may have heard of named Kevin Mitnick, who appeared at the conference and basically is telling some stories. You'll get this. You'll get 19 other equally good, maybe even more amazing DVDs, or talks rather. And if you pledge $125, you'll get 39 additional DVDs or talks. Again, 212-209-2950, $75 pledge, $125 pledge, your choice. And of course, everybody who pledges anything will get a special drawing from Rob T. Firefly, who's busy drawing right now. You get the microphone to pick up the sound of the pen on the paper there. Go ahead. Well, you got to draw for it to work. Well, that wasn't really anything. You just were scribbling there. All right. Well, yeah. All right. All right. He's busy doing that. 212-209-2950. Let's have a listen to Kevin Mitnick.
Very interesting to me. So I became involved in this area of phone freaking. And then because I'm a prankster, I took this area of phone freaking and I applied it to pulling pranks on friends. So one of the first things I did was I accessed a telephone company switch in Pasadena, California, and I was friends with another guy that was also into the phone freaking, and I changed the class of service on his home telephone to that of a payphone. So whenever he or his parents would try to make a call, I'd say, please deposit a quarter. That was fun. But what was even more interesting is intercepting directory assistance. There was a special way of calling a toll-free number, and then with the A, B, and C, D tones, you could actually set up intercepts on directory assistance around the United States. And they really fixed this flaw after we had fun with them for about a weekend. Especially Providence, Rhode Island, people would call in, and we get to play directory assistance operator. And you could imagine, 17 and 18 years old, the fun you could have, right? So people would call in, I'd say, what city? They'd say Providence, Rhode Island. I'd say, name please. They give me the name. And I'd say, hold on, I'm looking that up for you, sir. I'd say, oh, by the way, we're doing a survey. Do you mind spending about 15 to 20 seconds to complete our survey today? He goes, sure. I'd say, okay, one of our first questions, are you at home or in the office? I'm at home. Do you have our current yellow pages and white pages at home? Yes, I do. Then why are you calling me? Another call, someone, you know, what city? Providence, Rhode Island. May I have the name, ma'am? Sure, it's John Smith. Okay, one moment, please. That number is 555-21537. What? 555-21537. And they'd go, how do I dial a half? And I said, you know, between the one and zeros, you're dialing the phone, you just kind of give it a little bit of a nudge, or you can go down to our phone center stores, they existed at the time, and you can buy one of our new phones that has halves on it. Unfortunately, that fun only lasted for the weekend. Because we did a little bit more immature pranks, but I'm not going to go into that over here in this conference because I'm being recorded. And by the way, anything I talk about today, just my disclaimer, everything happened over 5 years ago, so it's past the federal statute of limitations. All right, so just so we know. Okay, perfect. But when I was in the amateur radio, I also was a prankster, and my target was my favorite, not my favorite, but the most well-known fast food restaurant in the industry, McDonald's. Have any of you played with McDonald's with radio in the audience? And you know what fun you could have, right? So when a customer drives up to the drive-in window and places an order, I, with my friends, parked across the street, could take over the system. So now the customer's not speaking to the guy inside with the headset, he's speaking to me. So you can imagine, right? Customer drives up, yes, may I take your order, please? Yada, yada, yada. And say, well, congratulations, you're our 50th customer today. Drive forward, your order's for free. And then I had a friend that did a really good Indian accent, right? So what happened is the customer would place the order, and it kept getting repeated back incorrectly, right? For, you know, for about 10 or 15 times, so the person loses patience. And then, of course, there was menu changes at McDonald's, where no longer were there hamburgers, french fries, and sodas. It was all burritos, tacos, and hot dogs. So after messing with this one McDonald's, this was in Hollywood, California, they put a sign on the drive-up window that it's closed because they kept getting messed with. So the manager of this McDonald's comes out right after we were playing with him for a while. He comes out and he's looking in the parking lot and he's looking for the culprit who's messing with, you know, their system. And he's looking around and he has no idea. Again, we're sitting across the street of a big boulevard. It's like right over here on Broadway. And we're watching, we're laughing in the car. And so this guy starts looking around. He sees nothing. He goes up to the drive-up speaker. And he's examining it. And he's looking at it like, you know, he's like it's possessed. And he's like looking around. And then he doesn't see anything. So he puts his face right next to the speaker. I couldn't resist. What the f*** are you looking at? And this guy, Lou. I never saw a guy run so fast except when. It was great. I mean, we had a great time with McDonald's. So, yeah, those were kind of interesting pranks. Back in 1988, I don't know if you know my kind of my history. That was the first time I was like federally busted for computer hacking. A friend of mine and I were hacking into a company called Digital Equipment Corporation. And what happens, we had a falling out, and he informed the FBI what I was doing, and they set up a sting operation. I was arrested. At the time, the federal prosecutors had told the judge that I had the capability of starting a nuclear war by whistling into a payphone. At the time I was in court, when I went to court for my detention hearing, as they call it, I was like expecting to get out, because I just spent 3 days in Terminal Island Federal Prison, and it wasn't a fun experience. And I go to court, and I'm ready, and I'm looking at, you know, when am I going to get out of here? And then when the federal prosecutor said that I could just whistle into a phone and start a nuclear war, I actually grinned because I thought he would lose all credibility with the court. But what happened is the judge says, you're absolutely right, Mr. Prosecutor. In fact, we need to make sure that he can't even get to a telephone in the prison. So I ended up in the hole in solitary confinement. But eventually I was released. And at that time, I was keeping my nose clean. I found new hobbies and new interests. And my brother called me one day, my half-brother, and he told me that this guy, Eric Hines, wants to speak with me, that he used to be a hacker, and he has a lot of interesting things he'd like to talk to me about. And I kind of really wasn't that interested. And my brother called me again, saying, this guy really wants to talk to you. So I called the telephone number. It turned out to be this guy that wasn't Eric, but what he would do is he would actually page Eric to his number and he'd conference it in like this ultra, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. So I finally get this guy on the phone, and he seemed very knowledgeable about phone phreaking. He knew a lot about the internal systems at the phone company. He knew about equipment in the central offices, and it intrigued me because I had a passion for technology. So we set up a meeting to meet at a hamburger hamlet. And I brought a friend of mine along, a guy named Louis DePayne, who incidentally was my hacking partner for a number of years. And we meet this guy, Eric, at a hamburger hamlet. And he starts telling us that he was part of the Kevin Poulsen case. Everybody familiar with Kevin Poulsen? Okay. And he starts telling me about all their escapades into phone company offices. I'm sitting there and I'm listening. And I said, so what happened to you? Because Poulsen was busted. He says, well, I was in Texas, and I was busted for doing some sort of credit card fraud, but they wanted some information about how I was doing the fraud, the FBI, so I cooperated with them and told them how I was able to commit these frauds. This is him telling me. And I got out early. I got a deal. I said, so they didn't ask you about Poulsen? He goes, no, they only wanted to know about me. Doesn't sound like the FBI I know. Usually they want to know about everything. So eventually, during the conversation, he says, we're talking about different systems at the phone company, you know, Cosmos, SCCS, I'm not going to go into MISR. Remember all these, familiar with all these names of internal systems at Ma Bell? And then he mentions a system called SAS. He goes, you know about SAS, don't you? I go, maybe, what does it do? He says, well, you can monitor anybody in Pacific Bell. And I go, no, I go, tell me more about it. And then he clammed up and didn't say another word, and the meeting ended. And I was intrigued. I wanted to find out. I didn't know about the system called SAS. What exactly is it? And how he told me he discovered it is he and Kevin Poulsen were actually in one of the phone company central offices, found the equipment, and were able to hook up a tape recorder and actually record the protocol going back and forth. So what I did is I called the phone company, and using my social engineering skills, I wanted to find out the company that developed this tool. And so after about, you know, two or three phone calls, I found out the name of the company that manufactured SAS. I do some research on this company, and I find out that they went out of business. They no longer are in business. So I did a little bit more research, and I found out the founders of the company tracked one of them at home, pretended to be a person working for Pacific Bell IT, and that I wanted to make improvements on the system, but I had no information. And the guy says, well, since we went out of business, do you want me to send you the design plans and the different protocols and everything? I could either FedEx it to you or I could fax it to you. What do you want? I said, sure, fax it to me. So then I had all the protocols and all the information of how to access SAS. And how SAS worked is they had remote RTPs, remote test points in every central office, and they had to use computer terminals in a test department at Pacific Bell, and it would talk to a concentrator. That concentrator would dial up to the RTP in each central office, and it would use a proprietary protocol, and it would give the test technician the ability to make calls from that number, to listen to the calls, to do a number of different test functions. So now I had the capability, like Eric had, of using SAS. So let's fast forward. This is kind of a lengthy story, but it's kind of interesting. So I started to get suspicious about Eric, because every time we'd get together or talk on the phone, he'd start like asking me questions. Who do you associate with? Who do you talk to? What are other hackers doing? And to me, that was a big red flag and yellow flag. So I started to wanting to look into, well, who is this guy? And at the time, the Public Utilities Commission did not tariff caller ID in California. But since I had switch access, I did. So I basically implemented caller ID in Los Angeles. I set up caller ID on a friend's telephone, and then at 3:30 in the morning, I called Eric's pager number to call his telephone number. He did, and we were able to ID the number, and then from there get the address information from the phone company. It turned out this went to the Oakwood Apartments in Los Angeles, California. Then I decided, well, I got to find a little bit more about Eric. I just know his name. I call the Oakwood, I find out from the phone company the unit number he's living in. I call up the rental office, pretending to be Oakwood corporate. I was able to get the whole rental application for the apartment where that phone terminated it. And to my surprise, there was no work information on this application. It only listed a mobile cell phone number. So I did some research and I found out that this mobile telephone number is listed in the name of Mike Martinez. And then to find out more information about this number, I needed to either be the customer and use social engineering, or I needed to get into the cellular phone company's network. At the time, I found a vulnerability in AirTouch Cellular, so I was able to get inside access to their internal network. What they gave me the ability to do is look at any calls that were originated from that cell phone or terminated. And one number that kept popping up over and over and over again was 310-477-6565, which is the headquarters of the Los Angeles FBI. So there I knew that there was a big problem for me because this guy was either an undercover agent or he was an informant. So why I'm telling you the story, too, is because I had to go through a lot of trouble to implement caller ID to get his telephone number. Now I'm going to show you how you could unmask private numbers, because if it happened today, he would have simply blocked his number. After I got the cell phone number, I pulled all the cell bills because I had access to all their internal systems. And then I started doing traffic analysis and found that this cell phone number was calling other phone numbers within government, other FBI cell phone numbers. And at the end of the analysis, I had every telephone number that belonged to the White Collar Crime Squad in Los Angeles. So what I started doing was having their numbers. I was able to do originating and terminating number searches. And then what I started doing was searching on Eric's number. Well, who's calling him within AirTouch Cellular? And who's calling Pacific Bell Security? And then I was able to find the case agent's cell phone number because he was calling Eric, he was calling Pacific Bell Security, he was calling different numbers at the Bureau. So then what I did is there was this device called the DDI. Is anybody familiar with it? A guy named Marky Sisselman in Milwaukee. And what the DDI device allowed you to do was monitor the forward and reverse control channel of a cell site and actually be able to see calls. Anybody remember the DDI device? Okay, maybe two or three hands. So at the time, I was working as a private investigator in Los Angeles, and I really hate to do this.
He went on for a good long time talking about this and so many other things that that he's been doing in his life, playing with technology, being prosecuted for playing with technology. But this is just one of the many talks that you'll get for calling 212-209-2950, pledging $125 for 40 talks from three conferences, or $75 for 20 talks from three conferences. This one in particular, Kevin Mitnick, you'll get for a phone call, 212-209-2950. I thought it was amazing how he just basically is recounting all of this. And I think this is really the only time he has done this publicly. He has his book coming out this summer. A book, it's actually about his history and the things that, the adventures that he's had in being locked up for many years in playing with technology. I thought it was amazing how he implemented caller ID in Los Angeles. That was something that he did before the phone company was actually doing it themselves. He was able to get access to a computer and do this so that he could find out who somebody was talking to. It's an amazing story. One of quite a bunch of stories that he has in this one talk. And this is just one talk of many that you'll get for calling 212-209-2950. Please get the phone lines lit up. We had a couple of calls while we were playing the excerpt, but we need to get a lot more than that if we're going to do respectfully this hour. Bernie, what do you think of that?
It was riveting stuff, Emmanuel. This show has a whole heritage of being for phone freaks. You know, the name of the show is Off the Hook. You know, it's a sort of like a triple entendre at this point. But anybody who's got phone freaking or curiosity about the phone system in their blood, and I think we all do, and I think a lot of people listening right now do, probably found that riveting stuff. I did, and I know a lot of other people that would find that riveting stuff. So you're going to get that DVD and 19 other DVDs if you call 212-209-2950 and pledge $75 or 40 DVDs of this kind of stuff. Actually, all kinds of stuff. This is just one sampling of the material you get as a thank you for pledging support to WBAI. You can get 40 DVDs for $125 by calling 212-209-2950.
We have one call on the line. I know there's more than one person out there that finds this material riveting and fascinating. Keep in mind, we're just playing a short excerpt of the audio here in the radio station. You get the video. You get so many more talks that than we have time to play tonight. You get keynote addresses. You'll get social engineering. You'll get the informants panel that we played excerpts from over the past couple of weeks, where the guy who turned in Bradley Manning, who is alleged to have leaked documents to WikiLeaks, faces a crowd of angry hackers, including you, Bernie, Kevin Mitnick, Fiber Optic, and myself, but also a room full of people. Very interesting talk, very interesting questions being asked, very direct controversy there. But there are so many other talks as well. Think of it, 20 different talks for a pledge of $75, 40 different talks for a pledge of $125. This is phenomenal. This is something that we don't offer very often. That's why we're doing it tonight. And this is the last night that we're on. We only have a half hour left. 212-209-2950. I still see just one call on the line. I know there's more than that. Mike, can you get more in?
I can try, but really it's up to the listeners to make the calls. Mm-hmm. 212-209-2950 is the number. So you get the radio station, which is really the greatest premium of them all. We get to keep doing what we do, but you also get your either 20 or 40 DVDs, just like the one we heard. But you can see it in video, and they're all at least an hour long. Some are longer, I think. And you'll also get an original drawing of a telephone that Rob T. Firefly is busy making right now. We posted a couple more pictures to the WBAI Twitter if you want to see what they look like.
What is that Twitter account?
It's WBAI_radio. So okay. twitter.com/WBAI_radio and click the links there and you'll get to see some drawings. And you'll get to own one if you pledge within the next 28 minutes, 212-209-2950.
And thanks to the person calling in right now. Please join that person. Let's see if we can get a handful of calls here at this particular point. We want to play another excerpt from a different talk that's part of this special package. But in order to do that, we need to see a flurry of calls come in, because if people don't call while we're playing the clips, then it doesn't make sense for us to play the clips. We need to get people calling so that we do well this hour, so that the station is here when we come back in 2 weeks. 212-209-2950. That right.
Yeah, you know, this is, you know, a big opportunity, because, you know, if you guys were listening to the show last week and you said, oh, I want this premium, well, here's your second and last chance for this fund drive.
We get emails all the time after the show.
Exactly.
People want to be able to pledge, and we only offer it during our show because it's such a fantastic offer that we'd go broke if we offered it all the time. That's why we only do it during the show. This is the last hour that we're on during this fundraiser. So if you want it, this is the time to call, 212-209-2950. We have two calls on the line, maybe three. Can't tell with this system here.
Well, Once this hour's over, that's it. These premiums will no longer be offered. You know, if you call in an hour from now, it'll be too late. You know, now's the time to call. Once you get to the end, once you get to 8 o'clock, that's it.
Rob, are you able? Okay, yeah. Don't distract yourself when you're drawing here. Rob is drawing, and everybody who calls gets one of his amazing pictures here. You can see them, robvincent.net, or look at the BAI Twitter feed, and you'll see the kind of quality you get. Every single drawing is going to be different.
I should also point out that these are all signed and dated and individually numbered tonight, so these are part of a set that's only being done here and now.
All right, now we have four calls on the line, so this is great. This is a good response. People, please, we're doing this because we believe in this place, and we know you do too. And if it weren't here, there is so much that we would not have been able to do. I don't think we'd be able to successfully run the conferences. I don't think we'd be able to do the magazine quite the same way that we've done in the past. We certainly wouldn't have had all the interviews and controversy. And in fact, just the Free Kevin campaign, the campaign to get Kevin Mitnick out of prison, that was orchestrated right here at the radio station. The campaign to get Bernie S. out of prison was orchestrated here at the radio station. Radio is a very important medium for getting the word out. Yeah, the internet is great, but there's a lot of noise on the internet, and you have to wade through it and find the material that is pertinent to what you're after. And the thing about radio is that, it's more selective. We're able to bring you stories that we know are of interest to you. You're able to call in and give us feedback and have a good back and forth. And plus, we'll be able to reach people who are just driving around in their cars, who just accidentally turn on the radio and come upon us. It's always a bit of a shock the first time, but that's how we get a lot of our listeners for life, and it's amazing. That's the magic of radio. Radio, I don't think, will ever be replaced by any other kind of technology. Certainly, the kind of radio stations that just play garbage all the time, just play music or commercials or whatever, yeah, you can replace that very easily. You can't replace WBAI, and that's why you don't see WBAI everywhere. You don't go down the dial, even here in New York, and find anything like it. It's that different, unique, priceless. 212-209-2950. Join the five calls on the line now, and please help support the place. Bicycle Mark, now you're all the way over here from the Netherlands, I understand, just to have this moment to tell the folks to call in.
Indeed, I came especially because I knew it was the fund drive. And
you could have just pledged the amount that you spent on the plane ticket for that, and we would have not had to do any of this.
I will rethink my actions next time.
We have to talk
about
this. Yeah.
Even in the Netherlands, and that's, I want to appeal to the international audience, because there are so many, and you guys know when you go to conferences, they come up to you. They listen to this, not only this program, they listen to this station, and they're everywhere in the world listening online, listening as a podcast, as WBAI does put out so much content for people who can't listen on the same schedule. And those people can also donate. We have the technology now, phones to call in and be a part of it. And I wanted to say this, I notice in my travels and as news develops over the years, so many personalities, so many issues that, yeah, they might get to conventional news programs and they get 30 seconds on WikiLeaks or on Kevin, but here you actually get to hear from them, and mm-hmm. not just a soundbite. You hear an entire conversation.
Absolutely.
And that's something unique to this place.
The interviews we do and the questions that people ask, it's something you just don't get anywhere else.
Hey, Bicycle Mark, can you issue in Dutch a special appeal to our Dutch listeners?
Yeah.
Because every Dutch person doesn't understand English as it is. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I would do it disservice. But yeah, either day. No, I'm not going to do it, actually.
Okay.
I just realized.
Well, that was a good start.
All right, yeah. So if that word made sense to you, then you must call 212-209-2950 and school us in some more Dutch.
No, not Kevin. You're here from Vermont, which is almost as far away as the Netherlands.
Just about.
And it's been a while since you've been on our airwaves, but have you seen a place to replace WBAI?
Absolutely not. No? I mean, as soon as I walked in the door here, I couldn't just stop smiling, because it just brings back all these great memories of sitting in this room.
Yeah, you kind of freak some people out with that.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
For all our video listeners, you're maybe watching us over the radio. I apologize. But this place is just, it's irreplaceable.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of content that it comes out of these shows are just, you cannot find anywhere else. Literally anywhere else. What other radio station would play that kind of clip of Kevin Mitnick talking about hacking the phone network or...
Mm-hmm.
You know, implementing caller ID.
Or what kind of radio station would play the kind of clip we're about to play now, which is our second clip of the day. And I want to thank people calling in. Give the number out one more time. Bernie, maybe you give the number out one more time, since you seem to always be able to get calls to come in.
It's 212-209-2950. Please call now, and we'll send you an amazing thank you gift of 20 DVDs or 40 DVDs if you pledge $75 or $125, respectively. 212-209-2950.
And everybody who pledges gets a picture drawn right now by Rob T. Firefly, busy at work here in the studio. 212-209-2950. Okay, now we're going to play something from the next hope, the most recent hope, the one that took place in 2010. This is part of the WikiLeaks keynote address. We were supposed to have Julian Assange appear, but because of the activity that took place, namely Adrian Lamo turning in Bradley Manning and causing all manner of controversy and chaos, Well, that came to the conference in a different talk, and that talk is also included. But we replaced Julian Assange with Jacob Applebaum, who's another spokesperson for WikiLeaks. And this is a bit of what he had to say at that particular time. Again, 212-209-2950. That's our phone number. Please give it a call and pledge what you can afford. 212-209-2950. Let's listen to the WikiLeaks keynote.
Hello to all my friends and fans in domestic and international surveillance. I'm here today because I believe that we can make a better world. Julian, unfortunately, can't make it because we don't live in that better world right now, because we haven't yet made it. I wanted to make a little declaration for the federal agents that are standing in the back of the room and the ones that are standing in the front of the room, and to be very clear about this, I have on me, in my pocket, some money, the Bill of Rights, and a driver's license. And that's it. I have no computer system, I have no telephone, I have no keys, no access to anything. There's absolutely no reason that you should arrest me or bother me. And just in case you were wondering, I'm an American, born and raised, who is unhappy. I'm unhappy with how things are going. I've dedicated my life to helping other people who need help in general, and specifically I work with human rights activists. I work with people who care about a woman's right to choose, the ability to freely vote. I work with people who are working for some kind of social change that is positive in this world. This is extremely important to me, and I don't expect all of you to do this as well, but I expect you to support me, and I expect you to support the activities that take place that are in support of these things. To quote from Tron, I fight for the user. I've done some other things. They're not really that important, but they're in line with what I believe WikiLeaks is in line with. I want to teach people. I want people to learn. I want them to collaborate. I want them to cooperate. And I want them to be able to speak freely without fear of retribution. That's why I work on NoiseBridge, and that's why I work on Tor. I think that if you can, you should organize. You should organize locally in order to make things like this possible. You should help people in whatever way that it is possible. You should also write free software if you have the opportunity, because it is only then that people will be able to trust what you do. There are people whose lives depend on software the hacker community writes. It's kind of a scary thing to think of that, considering some of the quality, but in general, it's extremely important. So you should consider the fact that it's not just about politics. And I am here speaking on behalf of WikiLeaks. I am not here as a representative of the Tor Project who employs me. I'm sure that they probably would not be too unhappy with me speaking here right now, but they certainly didn't know about it before this moment. So I believe that we are complicit in crimes against humanity when we know about them and when we don't stop them. I think that it is quite clear to me that every single person in this room has in some way contributed to the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And I wonder how you all feel about knowing that you are the ones, I am the one, that has funded every bullet that has shot a child, and every woman who has to come home to a family that has been decimated by troops, where there is no justice, where people don't have recourse of any kind whatsoever, where the standard operating procedure is for someone to take a 50 caliber machine gun and shoot across the engine block and kill the driver. I'm not sure that that's the world I want to live in, and I'm not sure that that's the world I want to fund. I'm pretty sure it's not. How about you guys? What do you think? Is that what you want? That's good. So what are you doing to change it? I guess it depends if you're Branson or not. I grew up listening to how terrible things were in the world before. And the neoconservative lie, and it is a lie, is that when the Berlin Wall fell, history ended. And we were in a new world of prosperity with no problems anymore. But actually, that's not the case. We all live in a mythology. And the mythology that we're living in is that America does no harm. And that is simply not true. I believe that in general, Americans are very good and they want to do the right thing. And I think that's why none of you are rushing the stage and trying to hurt me right now. But we condemn the past while funding the future. that we would condemn if it were our past. It doesn't really make sense. So I want to quote from one of my personal heroes. I was going to give you a quote from my friend Daniel Ellsberg, but I think that Moxie Marlin Spike fits with this crowd a little more. Right? He's a fantastic fellow, and he really has inspired me. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for him. He helped me to engage with the world in a way that I couldn't previously understand. And he says, "What about the truth has helped you?" And I always give him countless examples. And so what I want to hear from people is on a regular basis how the truth has helped them. We have to dismiss with the cynicism. Sincerity is the new black. So tell me, has the truth helped you? Write about this. Publish it. Tell people how it has helped you. Show that when you learn new things, that they have affected you in some way, and that you have affected other people, that some good ripples out in your network as a result of knowing things. This is extremely important, considering the fact that we teach you things, we tell you things, and we give you documents. We need people to do analysis on those documents, so you guys can be the ones that can actually say how truth has helped you. And I'll tell you why. There are some people, I would say, in the hacker community that quite simply just don't believe this statement. But this is from the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. He says, "And mankind's sole salvation lies in everyone making everything his business, in the people of the East being vitally concerned with what is thought in the West, the people of the West vitally concerned with what goes on in the East." That is our job. When you ignore the injustices of the world, you are a part of the problem. There is no question about that. And it is certainly the case that when you fund it, you are the problem. So, here's the solution that my friends and I have come up with. Certainly not my idea, but I'm on board 100%. We believe that it is absolutely necessary to accept documents that are relevant. Relevant because they are classified, censored, or otherwise restricted. This is extremely important because this is the type of material that is going to be able to make the most amount of change. When it is accepted to us, we have a pretty strong vetting process. Part of this, and what makes it safe for people to use us, is that we have very strong support for anonymity. We're uncensorable. You can try to take us down. But for those of you that have read The Mentor and what he's had to say about hackers, you know that you can't stop us. There's just more of us. And the important thing is that we actually use the rule of law. The rule of law is actually, despite my anarchist tendencies, very important. It is protection of the press that allows me to be here right now, and it allows Julian to travel freely throughout the world. Because people would like to shoot the messenger. There is no question about this. We believe that we are not the only game in town, but we believe that we are specifically a functional whistleblowing platform that is useful for people with the promises that we have made. We think that other people might shine in important ways, but we have a very specific set of goals, which is to make a giant impact. The purpose of this is not profit. You can't change the world if you're setting out to make a profit all of the time. The benefit has to be a cooperative one. It's absolutely important to not think of this as a competitive thing of any kind. And this promise that we make about it being a public service, sometimes I think people might criticize. For example, when we took down the site for a period of time for some re-engineering, and when we asked for donations. But there is no question that these documents will always be available. And, of course, we plan to release a lot more. The purpose of releasing this is that we think that special access is probably not the way that we can make a free and democratic society realized throughout the entire planet. We think that it's absolutely important that you don't have to be someone special to verify something or to get information. Think about it this way. How can you trust the media when the media does not behave like a scientific paper? How do you know that when someone tells you something, that it is true? You don't, unless you have the original facts. And so that's the purpose of this, to give you the original facts. Of course, there will be interpretations. Of course, there will be people that do analysis on this. But the purpose here is to give you the facts so you can draw your own conclusions, to give you the data so that you have the ability to make your own analysis. And specifically, and most importantly, we aren't going to back down. When the media is gagged, we refuse to be gagged. We refuse to be silent. There is no reason, absolutely. There is no reason whatsoever that we should back down. And we refuse to do so simply because you cannot erase the past. These things that have transpired must be known, and the mere fact that people fight to erase the past, as if it has not happened, should be quite an indicator of something being very, very wrong, not just with this country, but with every country in the world that attempts to do this. And so, we have a history of doing this. Let me explain how it works. We have a pretty good process. We like to say that we have around 1,000 people involved. There's a lot of people involved. There are a lot of people here right now that support us in various ways, and thank you for that. You know who you are, and I don't know who you are. And thank you for that also.
Okay, we're going to have to fade there, but that's Jacob Applebaum giving the WikiLeaks keynote address at the Next Hope in 2010. And yeah, it's a little bit outdated because he did mention that Julian Assange is free to travel wherever he wants, and obviously that's not true anymore. Wow, what a talk that was. Simply incredible hearing straight from the horse's mouth, one of the people directly involved with the entire WikiLeaks process. How it all works, the importance of it, the importance of the hacker community, and speaking to a crowd like our crowd at the Next Hope in place of Julian. Obviously, Julian wasn't able to make it then, but certainly he was in our thoughts, and I'm sure we were in his thoughts as well. Bernie, some pretty powerful stuff there, eh?
Extremely. And if you've been paying attention to the news since last July, when this keynote speech was made by Jake Applebaum of WikiLeaks, you have heard tons of information about WikiLeaks, and you had heard tons of stories that major media outlets released who obtained their documents through WikiLeaks and reported major news stories week after week after week, and you were listening just now to an insider at WikiLeaks explaining how that organization works, why it's so important, and why you should support it. And along the same themes, you should also support WBAI because we support that type of effort.
That's right. 212-209-2950 is the phone number. For that, for calling that number and pledging $75, you'll get the WikiLeaks keynote that you just heard an excerpt from. You'll get the Kevin Mitnick address that we heard something from before. You'll get social engineering and a whole bunch of other things. You'll get a total of 20 different talks. That's for a pledge of $75. For a pledge of $125, you'll get a total of 40 talks from three different conferences in 2006, 2008, and 2010. Some really fascinating stuff there. And of course, everybody who calls in 212-209-2950 and pledges, you'll get a custom-made picture being drawn right now by Rob T. Firefly. How's it going over there, Rob?
Not bad, not bad.
All right, good. Yeah, you're sweating a little bit, but I think I think you're going to you're churning out the pictures here. It's really kind of cool watching the process unfold. 212-209-2950. We're over $1,000, which is great. And we want to thank the people for calling in throughout the hour tonight. We're only on for another 10 minutes, though. And if you want to take advantage of this package, which I think is an incredible deal, you have to give a call now, 212-209-2950. Use your credit card if you wish. And pledge whatever it is you can afford, no matter where you are in the planet. We are offering this this particular selection for WBAI listeners for the next 9 minutes. 212-209-2950, 20 talks for $75, $125 pledge will get you 40 talks. And some really, really good material here. Want to thank some people, Mike?
Yeah, sure. Let's thank Eric, who's from Wyoming, for pledging. Matthew, who's from St. Albans, West Virginia. Justin from Port Jefferson, New York, and Giancarlo from Henderson, Nevada.
We have a lot more people to thank too, but it's so hectic down there that we don't have all the names yet. And we see a bunch of calls coming in now. 212-209-2950. Please join those people. Make it a little bit more hectic down there so that we have a good shot at making 2,000 this hour.
I was going to ask you, you think we can make 2,000?
I think we can do it. Sure. We made 4,500 last week and we were on for 2 hours. So it's certainly possible we could do 2,000 if enough people call in. We have 3 calls on the line now. How many people were down there when you visited?
More than 3.
Okay, so we have space for more people to call in, and if they do, then we can certainly we're up to 1195 now. We can get up there with people's help, and that's how the radio station runs. That's how we do things. It's everybody adding something, and it gets greater and greater, and that's how it's been working since we began back in 1960. Got red.
Now, one thing I love about what I just heard with Mike reading off those names is how many of those were from different states all over this country. That's a fantastic mm-hmm. thing. Not only are we talking about free speech, we're talking about free speech that gets around. You know, help support that. Help keep that on the air. Help keep that, you know, free speech traveling across the country and around the world.
Around the world, too. Absolutely. And we have people from as we talked about with Bicycle Mark, from the Netherlands, where you live right now. People listen to WBAI over there, don't they?
And last year, I was, if I can tell a story, I was working in Afghanistan, in Kabul. Mm-hmm. And even in Kabul, I would run into people, international people from all over the world,
uh-huh.
who also listen to WBAI
no,
programming.
No, really?
Yes.
In Afghanistan?
They do.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing work. It's a highly stressful environment. You can get your news from other places, but they choose to, you know, WBAI is one of their sources.
Can you speak in their native tongue and give an appeal for people to call in and pledge? No,
no, but I'll go back and learn.
You can speak Portuguese, though.
Yes, I can.
Can you give an appeal in Portuguese?
Tá bem. Para todos os nossos ouvintes, faz favor telefonar o programa para dar o apoio ao nosso trabalho aqui e à nossa qualidade de trabalho.
See, I knew we had a foreign language in you somewhere. We just had to drag it out. You know, I always thought Portuguese sounds a little like Russian. Does anybody tell
agree,
you that?
I agree. And in Russia, I tried it out.
Uh-huh. Didn't work,
no.
huh?
But they smiled as if they heard something familiar.
They just smiled as if they heard a lunatic trying to communicate with them with gibberish.
I don't think, Bicycle Mark, though, that you said the phone number, which, of course, is 212-209-2950. So people can call that number, whatever their native language, and pledge their support. Just as Dot Red was saying, how people are pledging from all over the world, I got handed two more names, John, who's from Maryland, and America, who's from Roseland, New Jersey, and many more anonymous people and many more people who are still calling right now that we won't have time to thank.
We have five calls on the line. Join those five calls, and we might have to send some more people down to Tally to help out. In fact, not Kevin, why don't you say your goodbyes and join people down the hall?
Goodbye, radio. Please, all right. Pledge.
Hope we see you again sometime soon. It's not Kevin all the way from Vermont joining us tonight. 212-209-2950 in our last few minutes. We're not on next week. We won't be doing this next week, so if you want the package, you have to call now. Again, 20 DVDs, or 20 talks, actually, from the last three Hope conferences for a pledge of $75, and 40 DVDs for a pledge of $125. And these are the greatest hits of the Hope conferences, of the last three Hope conferences. You'll get Kevin Mitnick, you'll get the WikiLeaks talks, you'll get keynotes, you'll get social engineering, you'll get all kinds of things. It'll have you riveted to your TV set or computer for days, months to come. It's a fantastic deal. And, of course, everybody who calls in and pledges any amount will get a custom drawing from Rob T. Firefly. Rob, you want to tell us something about the drawing you're doing right now?
The one I'm doing right now is actually a phone of mine that I sort of smashed for the purposes of the image.
You smashed the phone?
Yeah,
just to draw a picture.
It's kind of broken now.
Wow.
But this is the sacrifice I make for my art. But there's only
destroy equipment so you can draw pictures of it. That's amazing. That's an artist for you.
And there's only one of these.
That's right. 212-209-2950. Get your own personalized Rob T. Firefly picture. And you can look at his art at robvincent.net. But the most important thing, give a call to the radio station to support the radio station. Keep us going. Keep us here for the years ahead, decades ahead. 212-209-2950. I think that's going to just about do it for us here tonight. We have down to four calls on the line right now, so hopefully we can get a few more, and we have a chance at making 2,000 this hour. Again, 212-209-2950. Get the Hope packages, $75 or $125. Get the Rob T. Firefly artwork, and we will see you in 2 weeks. Thanks, everybody, for calling in. You're what make it all possible. 212-209-2950. Good night.
And you're tuned to WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. The time is 8 p.m. It's 8 in the evening. Well, I just woke up. Yeah, I'm the overnight engineer, so to me it is 8 in the morning. And we will be hearing Joe and Hank in just a moment. And again, I say that you must understand that to me, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, so if I'm slow, please understand. Okay. See, I think I've got your theme up. Let's see. I think it's, it's number one, isn't it?
Two.
It's two. Okay, here we go.
And good evening, good evening, good evening. This is Joe King, and welcome to the Personal Computer Show at 8:01:20 Eastern Standard Time.
And today is May the 18th.
All day. And part
all
of
day.
And part of tonight. And from the West Coast, we're going to be joined shortly by David Perry, who's the...
He's the guru.
He's
the guru on malware.
The malware guru.
Yes. Hey, Joe, we have some good news to tell the folks.
We do?
Yes.
We don't. We very rarely get an opportunity to give the folks good
news. Well, let me ask you, how often are we on the air for 2 hours?
Never, never. Haven't been on the air for 2 hours since 1996.
But guess what? We're on for 2 hours tonight.
Oh, I'm leaving. I can't put up
with 2 hours. Yes, you can. You know what? It's not the 2 hours you object to. It's you have to put up with me for 2 hours.
That's
right?
What I was about to say. I have to put... I can't... Behind the gray-green console tonight, we have Sidney Smith, Uncle Sidney.
Uncle Sidney.
I was talking to Uncle Sidney before the show, and I was saying to him that, he's been around WBAI as long as I've been around. I've always known Uncle Sidney, and he pointed out to me that he's been around here for about 5 years longer than I've been around, and I've been around longer than dirt.
You know what the irony is? We're both older than him, and we call him Uncle Sidney.
That's right.
Well, Sidney, your mic's live, right?
Yes, it is.
The reason we call you Uncle Sidney is because you remind me of Uncle Don.
Uncle Don?
Uncle Don, yes, a famed radio pioneer and children's show host who is thought to have said, that ought to keep the little is happy.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, well, as it turns out, he never said that. That was one of those urban legends of radio.
And that urban legend has lived on longer
than anyone knows where it came from.
First of all, his show was a radio show aimed specifically at children, grade school age children.
Well,
and he was sponsored by, I believe, a peanut butter company. Jell-O. He was sponsored by Jell-O pudding and Jell-O desserts.
Well, we're not going to give them too much mention.
And everybody assumed...
J-E-L-L-O will not mention them at all.
Why? You know, this is non-commercial radio, right?
Well, maybe they'll send me a case of it in the morning.
Hey, you know, we have David Perry on the air.
Do we?
I'm
David,
here,
are you
and
with
I'll
us?
Talk about, I will talk about children's radio and television all day long. My favorite being... only a mere 57 years old.
Wait a minute. When the heck were you a child?
In the late 50s and early 60s.
Now you remember Winky Dink then.
Winky Dink? I remember Sky King.
Sky King and a songbird. Yes, indeed.
Right. And his niece Penny, whose idea of a good time was to get tied to a chair.
Wait a minute. I want to test you out here. Sky King landed his plane at what ranch?
Circle Bar H Ranch.
That's right.
Okay, right. You guys are with it. You guys
okay,
are
I remember
it.
That.
Now,
for
those of you in the audience who have no idea what we're talking about, if you just take off the box top, or in lieu of a box top, you can take off the top of your parents' grand piano, if they have a grand piano.
And there really is a Battle Creek, Michigan, by the way.
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where I got, remember those little frog men? You put the
baking soda
baking soda in the bottom foot, and it goes up and down. And then they had the...
weren't those Nabisco?
Yes, that's right.
No. Nabisco was the National Biscuit Company. Grand Rapids, Michigan was Kellogg's.
Oh, and Kellogg's...
Battle Creek.
Kellogg's had the little model of the Nautilus that operated on the same principle as the frogmen.
Yes, well, right. Everybody had the same thing. However, when they discovered, I think it was about 4 years ago, that little children were swallowing them and choking to death and being murdered, they stopped doing that.
That's why, by the way, that's why Cracker Jack stopped putting those neat little games and toys in their boxes of Cracker Jacks because children were swallowing them.
No, but it wasn't little children. Mm. That was their parents at the ball games who weren't looking at what they were doing and they were eating the toys.
By the way, while you guys are talking about the 50s, I can talk about the very, very late 50s. Mm. When I was working with a vacuum tube computer, ANFSQ7. I wonder how many people know what that is.
No, forget that. How many people know what a vacuum tube is?
Sure they
know. My dad was the champion vacuum tube salesman of the West Coast.
No, that was vacuum cleaner salesman.
and won the golden tube from GE Tubes.
My older cousin probably did business with your dad. He had a TV repair company.
Do you know that after the end of the year, you can ask the question, do you remember the incandescent lamp or incandescent bulb after the end of this year?
No, they're just going to stop manufacturing them in this country, but not where they're really made.
No, you can't. You can't be sold here either.
They're banning the sale of incandescent bulbs.
Yes.
Wow.
I hadn't heard that. Yep. That's interesting.
Does this mean I have to hoard my last few boxes to be sold
actually,
on eBay?
Well, actually, I'm not concerned about using these new,
compact fluorescents?
Yeah, compact. I'm not. But you know what my problem is? There's no compact fluorescent for a refrigerator, the oven, and so on. I have to stock up on those bulbs.
Well, it's more than that. You know all the hundreds of thousands of chandeliers that our grandmothers left for us?
Use candles like they did.
Oh, dear.
That is the lesson there, isn't it?
Hey, listen, what is the magic phone number that we have here?
The magic phone number? Oh, before we go into that, let me tell the folks this. First of all, we're not going to be taking on-the-air phone calls because our phones are being devoted to those of you who want to support WBAI, want to support the Personal Computer Show. Well, you can call in on a number and make a pledge, and we'll tell you some of the premiums we have, but you don't need a premium to make a pledge. You just, a credit card would help, but you can just make a pledge by calling 212-209-2950. And while some of you are listening out of town by, there's hundreds
some,
of...
Some. You say some. We did very well 2 weeks ago from people from out of town, Joe.
Well hundreds of people are listening to what is called the Internet stream. Those of you who are listening on it know what I'm talking about. And those of you who don't, I'll point out that even if you're not within the earshot of the Empire State Building from whence we broadcast... you can listen by going to WBAI.org and listening to one of the streams. And those people can go to WBAI.org and make a pledge there online using PayPal or a credit card or some other means of pledging money. And incidentally, Hank will be telling you about some of the various premiums we've put together over the period of time. I shouldn't say we've put together. He has put together. Those of you who would just like to make a small pledge because you don't have that much money, you perhaps are part of the great Bush economic revolution, which has left us with 9% or 10% unemployment. And you can make a pledge through PayPal of your favorite show, just about anything that you want to make a pledge for. 212-209-2950. For those of you who want to talk to a live person and find out about the pledges and so on, or, as I say, WBAI.org. Now, Hank, I know that we're going to be on for quite a while, and would you like to just give everybody a highlight of what kind of pledges we're talking about? And then like to get to some really important stuff on that has nothing to do with fundraising that that David Perry of Trend Micro can fill us in on in a few seconds.
Before I get there, can I ask Uncle Sidney a question?
Sure.
So, Uncle Sidney, did you know Charles Morgan?
Personally, no.
That's what got me started on Pacifica. I live out here in L.A., and I used to listen to Charles Morgan, and I swear, if he was alive today, politics would actually make sense. He could actually make sense out of the whole
thing. Oh, wait a minute. Morgan in the Morning, yes?
Yeah, Charles E. Morgan.
Yes, 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 yes. You know, he was here at WBAI before we were Pacifica. I know who you're talking about. No, I didn't personally know him.
Oh, okay.
Sidney, back in the...
No, I didn't know Chaucer either. I didn't know, Lincoln either.
I thought you knew Beowulf, though. Yeah,
yes, I did. We used to play cards.
We used
Friday
to play
nights.
Cards.
Beowulf.
But back in the day, there was on 6th Avenue, and I think it was 4th Street, perhaps, There was upstairs on the second floor, there was a place where you could listen to folk music. What was it called? The Fret Shop or something like that? Which was the home of folk music in the village.
Izzy Young's Folk Shop?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he had
a show here.
Which is what I was about to say. Which is what attracted me to listening to the station in the first place. I was not particularly concerned with the politics of the station. But it had some of the best folk music in the business.
Mm. And what year would this be that you're talking about?
Oh, I'm talking now here.
It was early. He had a show early to mid-60s. Many people who went on to become names in the folky and later folk rock and then later rock world.
Sure. No, I'm a big old folky.
Okay, there you go. Then they all showed up here at WBAI. Before Mr. Dillon was famous, he, of course, was here.
Well, he was there, and he used to play at a place called Gertie's Folk City. Uh-huh. And the
Gertie's
Bitter
Folk City
End,
and Café Watt, too.
Yeah, yes, yes.
I remembered, I suddenly can't think. Who was the folk musician who played the